Hello and welcome to episode 170 of The Great and Crowbar. It is the 12th of December 2017, and I fucked that up. It's 2016.
Oh yeah.
My name is... I knew it was a year-related thing we were doing. I wasn't sure exactly what it was. My name is Chris Thurston, and tonight I am joined by Tom Francis.
Hello.
Tom Senior. And Philippa Waugh.
Hi.
I apologise in advance if leaning forward to make sure I'm in shot ever obscures your entire face.
I'm going
to
make it look like you've got, like, extra arms, a leg, hand growing out of your head.
So that will mean nothing to you if you're listening to this via iTunes, whatever you use for podcasts, but... As we did last year, for last year's sort of end of year special episode, we are recording this on a camera as well as on a microphone.
Mm-hmm.
And what this allows us to do, somehow, is put the podcast on YouTube. So you can look at it, as some of you probably are now, and therefore don't require that explanation.
We do anyway put it on YouTube, but this time you'll be able to see something other than the box.
Those people who've just been watching a stationary box for 2 years are going to be really shocked when this turns up their theme and some of those people.
Once per year. One day a year we take material form.
Are you going to put the box version up just so that...
Okay, yeah. We'll put up both. We'll put up the video version and the traditional box version.
Can you do like an image annotation on YouTube so you just turn on annotations and it replaces our faces with a giant Great Mobile logo?
Ooh.
Could do, yeah. We'll see in show notes to find out what options you have for making this not happen. So, like last year, we're actually going to nick that formula entirely. This is going to be the last podcast of the year, the calendar year 2016. And as such, rather than do the normal structure, we are going to go through our games of the year. But like last year, rather than do... you know, like making choices about which games are the best on a list. We've put all of the games onto one massive list.
So we chose the games that we thought were best and put them on a list.
Yeah, but with almost no process to whittle this down.
Oh, okay.
And as such, we're just going to talk about all of them. We should also say before we begin that tonight we are drinking really amazing bourbon. And which is nice for a change. And like,
it is Smooth Ambler Old Scout 10 straight bourbon whiskey, at least 10 years old. And it's so fancy, or I don't know if fancy or like whatever the word is, but
autism.
It's hand labeled which batch number it is and when it was bottled. And it was bottled by Tori.
Thanks, Tori. But more specifically, though, thanks to Dylan, who is the listener, not reader.
Yep.
Who really kindly sent this to us.
Yeah,
so I just wanted to read that little card. It says, for the Great and Crowbar podcast, cheers to Pip, Chris, both Toms and Phantoms, Marsh and Graham. Happy holidays from the colonies and thanks for hours of enjoyment. Dylan Neberjoth Herbert.
Aww.
So, no, genuinely cheers.
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 This is awesome. And so we thought we'd save it to this special end of the episode so you can look at it. So we've not been sponsored by booze. That would actually be an amazing idea.
It is 50%.
We're doing it wrong because it's facing away from the camera anyway.
Let's, yeah.
You see it briefly, but then also we're going to put a chilling sleeve on it.
Yeah.
Hide your shame, beautiful bottle. So that's brilliant. And it's apparently 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's going to be a good one.
See you in 2 hours. However, that reference to Marsh and Graham brings me on to the next thing that I was going to say, which is that because obviously, you know, this was the year that we lost.
lost a lot of good men this year.
Two good friends to Jersey and Sweden, respectively.
Terrible diseases, just like the rest of us.
Exactly. Graham and Marsh, Crate and Crowbar from the beginning. Now, fine. But far away. they also contributed to this list, and they sent us their personal games of the year. Tom, do we have them to hand?
We do.
But are they over there, where they're hard to get to?
They're not difficult to get to. Okay. They are Ghosts of Christmas Past. Marsh just told us his top 10 without prompting.
So what we're going to do is we're going to read their top 10s, because that actually is like a curated list, and with their comments on it. Some of their games are also in here, but in some cases they've brought up games that we don't really know anything about or haven't played.
Yeah. Or don't like.
So those games...
We know them well, we disagree.
Or we just flat out disagree, the division.
Yeah.
But those games have been put on this, not been put on this list, because it would be pointless for us to go and try and talk about them. So to clarify our process for the one person who's interested.
So, Graham's list. I'll go like Actually, no, I'll go 10 to 1. There'll be a small element of suspense.
Yes.
this is Graham, did you say?
Yeah, Graham. Okay. Number 10, Firewatch. 9, Thumper. 8, XCOM 2. 7, American Truck Simulator. 6, Overwatch. 5, Tom Clancy's The Division. Eyebrows raised here at the rest of the whatever number is next, The Curious Expedition. Deus Ex, Mankind Divided. Duskers. And at number 1, Devil Daggers.
Number 1.
And Graham says, Rainbow Six Siege came out in December the 1st of 2015, which is basically 2016. So if that counts, I'd put that on there in place of XCOM 2, Thumper, and Firewatch. Which is not how it this.
It is a combination of those games, so that's fine.
Why Devil Daggers? It was the game I played most this year, returning to it again and again for quick blasts in the same way I used to with games like N, Trackmania, and Spelunky. Hey, did I ever talk on the pod about how much I like Spelunky? Devil Daggers is those games of first-person shooter. Quake's atmosphere and art style, e.g. Skulls, and Shotgun and Lightning Gun boiled down into an arena shooter with brilliant feel, enemy design, and power-up system. It's simple but whip-smart. And Marsh's List, starting at 10. He's numbered his, so I don't have to keep count. Counting backwards is harder than you think. Number 10, Dishonored 2. Shockingly low, although it wasn't at all on Graham's list, so I guess that's a step up.
It wasn't on mine either.
Gasp.
How can anyone disagree about video games? Number 9, Inside. 8, Abzu. 7, Samaras 3. 6, Deus Ex Mankind Divided. And then, I have to read this in reverse, because at this point, Marsh notes that there's a non-trivial increase in enthusiasm for the rest of the list. Number 5, Overwatch. Number 4, Grow Up. Number 3, Dark Souls 3. Number 2, Uncharted 4, which is not a PC game. And number 1, The Witness.
Wow.
That's surprising, actually. Both played that at the same time. We talked about it a lot.
Also, I'm not really sure what a non-trivial increase in enthusiasm means for Marsh, really.
It was because it's Marsh. It was in the other order, and then it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then non-trivial reduction in enthusiasm. And then, like, I don't know about the rest.
I didn't realise you'd switched it to make it more optimistic.
Well, because they went in reverse order, whereas it doesn't make any sense when I now say reduction in enthusiasm as it gets to his top 5.
Right.
Marsh justifies his Witness pick with, well, I guess if I'm not allowed to pick Cobalt for all 10 spots, which is a game that is published by Mojang, who he now works for, then my number one game is The Witness, more for what it represents to me than its exquisite construction. Its puzzle design and message aside, The Witness was such an aesthetic pleasure, such a place of ruminative beauty and respite that, as this year has drawn on and grown immeasurably grim, I feel a yearning not just to return to the game, but actually fucking emigrate there.
You already emigrated to Sweden.
You're going to stop emigrating. You can't run from all of your problems, Marsh. Especially wow, not to The Witness. Few games have inspired such a painful longing, now rooted in a more hopeful past, impossible to retrieve. Such a downer.
Oh, he's killing it this year, and by it, I mean everything.
Of course, my private puzzle island would ideally have more goblin dicks, but I nonetheless respect Jonathan Blow's vision.
Oh,
thank you very much,
Graham
and Marsh. It's fascinating insight to people who are now lost to us forever.
Yeah, indeed.
It's like they're in the room, but not in the room.
Maybe we should like superimpose floating pictures of them as though they died.
The editing process for this pod is getting out of hand.
2013 to...
I'll see if I can do that. I can do that. Because actually one thing we will miss is last year's competition that we managed to run during the podcast. Because Marsh quietly doodled a dick on the list.
Right.
And I saw him do this, but we did like a spot the ball type competition where I asked people to guess when during the pod, Marsh, this is excellent bourbon, Marsh had drawn a dick. So I don't know whether we can pre-plan some of that this year, but maybe I could just do spot the ghost of Marsh that I will insert creepily Fight Club style into some rogue frame.
You zoom in on one of the fairy lights. His face will be within.
It'll be something like that. So, yeah. So, a lot of those games are also on this list because we also picked them. A lot of them, such as The Division, again, aren't. For excellent reason. So, actually, let's start where Marsh left off with The Witness.
Yeah.
Which I didn't get around to playing. So,
Witness,
I'm out.
The Fitness. That just always comes into my head every time. I
can't not think the phrase "come on, get up, get down with the witness" every time your mothers get up, get down with the witness. Every time I hear the name of that game, and that's my sole involvement with it.
Such a faithful rendition that you're going to get us sound blocked for copyright.
Sorry, YouTube.
Is it too late to fly Marsh in to talk about this? I did play The Witness and I enjoyed The Witness. It is not on my game of the year list, but It is beautiful, and it has many good puzzles. I would argue it has many bad puzzles. But I think the moment stands out for me, my initial reaction, I kind of forgot about it a bit, and so that's why I was so surprised to see at number one on Marsh's list. And then I was thinking back to it and thinking, wasn't that just a bunch of mazes? And it was largely a bunch of mazes in a very pretty place, but every now and then it would kind of tie together in a really smart way. And I remember one puzzle where I discovered that as I was drawing on the maze actually represented the location I was standing in, and that my solution was a very easy puzzle, and I solved it one way, and then I changed the world in one way, and I realised, oh, the way it's changed the world has depended on how I've solved it. And the puzzle is not to solve the puzzle, because the puzzle is incredibly easy. It's how do you solve the puzzle in a way that then matches up to your environment to shift that in a way that you care about them. That was really smart. Mm.
It's also, it has a lot of, like, it does a lot of things like that where there's cool interactions between the environment and the puzzle that you're trying to solve at a given moment. But it also has a lot of just sort of bonus touches, almost like constant drip feed Easter eggs as you look around. Kind of to the point where posting screenshots is a precarious endeavour and you will get shouted at for spoiling something for someone as soon as you try. So, you know, you can just, like, maybe do a close-up of a grass blade or something and just hope for the best. But, yeah, I thought that it was really... there was a lot to do, even if you were stuck on a puzzle. You could go wandering, you could find other things to solve or tinker with or, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I wasn't as bothered about, like, the unfolding of the narrative or the, you know, the gradual reveal of... the island, I guess.
I forgot there was an ocean.
But there was still some kind of neat meta touches within that as well, and so I found it a really rewarding game, and it also had a nice way of ramping up puzzles. Like, it would drip feed you, like, it would show you maybe the easiest version and you'd get through that, and then it would sort of feed you on to the next bit of it, and that would teach you something slightly different, and then you'd get to the third one and realise that actually it wasn't quite what you'd assumed for the previous two. It was just that those had happened to work with that, and you'd have to sort of recalibrate your thinking. But it was, I liked on the whole the difficulty progressions within that, and I found it quite accessible and quite neat.
Did you, without spoiling anything, did you get a secret ending? You can kind of complete it and then you get
put back
to a place, and then there's another ending you can get.
There are definitely things I didn't do. So there's still a few sort of puzzles within that, I think, but I got to a point with it where I was done, and I didn't feel the need to, for example, 100% it or to go back and tinker with things that were left unfinished. It didn't feel like they were unfinished to the point where I cared more.
Yeah. It's like, getting the secret ending is not, the challenge isn't that interesting really, but the ending itself is just really weird and involves like footage of their office and stuff, and it's just...
Can I watch it on YouTube?
Yeah. Yeah, you would lose nothing really by just looking it up on YouTube if you want to do that.
I burned out real fast on grids in that game.
That'll kill the witness for you.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's really pretty. I enjoyed its shorter burst puzzles, but I found like some of them, like, they went on for a long time, even though the concept had already revealed itself. And I'd already kind of understood and basically mastered it. And there's a bit where you're building bridges where it just goes on and on and on. And I think I just put it down forever at that point. But I admire it, I think, for its craft.
I really like the biomes as well. They're beautifully crafted, and the island never felt too small or too crowded as a result.
Great biomes. Also, next, don't know why I'm talking like this, The Witcher 3, Blood and Wine.
Hooray. I really like this one, put it on the list, so I'll talk about it. It's just like a perfect expansion that builds on everything that was great about The Witcher 3, but cuts all the fat out of it. It gives you like an 8 or 9 hour campaign that it doesn't have the pressure of having to be an adventure about saving the world or, you know, crusading across, you know, multiple dimensions or anything ridiculous. It could just be like a local drama about vampires and duchesses and shit that's really exciting for that amount of time. And the quest's just so varied and so fun and just suddenly so dark and then coming back out and so jokey and jovial again. Like they understand the tone of that universe so, so well by this stage that they feel confident enough to play with it and make it playful and make it quite self-deprecating a lot of the time. So Blood and Wine has much more, it's many more jokes about Geralt and about the world he's in and about the sort of ridiculous knights and people he's interacting with. And you end up with this wonderful kind of self-aware RPG that's just absolutely gorgeous. It feels like going on holiday in southern Italy. Like you get your own vineyard at the end and you can sit down and get drunk with your butler and look out over the fields and be like, oh, I'm really old and grizzled. And you're like, yeah, Geralt, it's brilliant.
Because like games where you want to live there is already a theme, because that's what Marsh said about The Witness.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Also how I feel about Hitman's Final Mission.
Maybe everyone can nominate the game they would live in this year.
There's an amazing Toussaint, it's the place, it's really beautiful sun.
Isn't that a real place?
Yeah, I think so.
In America.
Not
maybe in Arizona. No,
yeah.
Like, I think that's, yeah, that's not spelt like The Witches, right. Toussaint. But I don't know how you say the one that's in Arizona. I think it would just be Toussaint.
I'd be amazed if this place was in Arizona. It's just this, like, elven castle in the middle. It's like,
yeah, that's an answer.
And it's surrounded all this beautiful green land and, like, lakes everywhere. But they still find a way to just put a good old-fashioned haunted cairn or haunted house. There's a brilliant haunted house story.
Or stupid old haunted Ken, which he stopped doing. Everyone hates him.
And
haunted Ken of Arizona.
Exactly.
There's a brilliant quest about spotted white, and you're going towards this just really spooky graveyard. And this
white
really
doesn't ghost.
Yes, yeah. Or it's kind of ghoul or whatever. And
a white in a can.
an old abandoned hut. There's just spoons hanging everywhere. Just like hundreds of spoons everywhere, and you open every drawer, it's full of spoons. And you go deeper. I don't know what
happens.
I was going to say the same thing.
But it's just these really intriguing and weird scenarios that give you turn into amazing haunted house quests.
Alanis Morissette songs.
Nice. But it's brilliant. I love it. And I feel sad that they've stopped making The Witcher.
You know, no one, like, people bang. I talked a lot before about having not played The Witcher, and people bang on about it so much in so many different contexts, and no one has said, like, the phrase, like, haunted Ken and the Temple of Spoons to me before, and that would have sold me instantly.
Well, so, no, but your problem is you want to play all of the games in order before you get to The Witcher.
This
3.
Very last thing.
Yeah,
maybe I should just get over that. Maybe that's my New Year's resolution.
It won't reward your investment for that, I don't think. I haven't played all of them. Well, I didn't finish the first one because it was bad.
Well, I mean, there must be a reason that you haven't, like, finished it. You've started them.
No, I wandered off, but I saw the story so many times.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Witcher 2 is not bad.
No, it's not.
Me wandering off from a game is not necessarily a sign that the game is bad.
Just watch it. Just watch on YouTube. That's what kids do nowadays.
They love it. They love it. They'll love this. This on YouTube.
Yeah.
What were we doing? Game of the Year. Next up is Dark Souls 3. This is a good game, wasn't it, Tom?
Very, very good. I feel like I'm muted on it because I played Bloodborne the year before. And that, for me, the whole Souls concept peaked with Bloodborne. And basically, I don't think they'll do ever better that. So Dark Souls felt like a bit of a tribute act, even though it was a really brilliantly made and excellent RPG.
I would say that it was the first one that I had, at least on PC, that I had played sort of in time with other people discovering it for the first time, and that was genuinely fun.
That's really cool.
Because I fell behind with Bloodborne quite quickly.
Yeah.
Which makes me one of the reasons the Bloodborne pod never happened. Sorry again. But Dark Souls 3, like, it has such a great... Yeah, it is the same tricks again, but it's even... The world is sufficiently different that it is still fun to discover what's different about this one, and what this boss is like, and to be surprised when you're getting, you know, fucked up by a giant tree or whatever.
Yeah,
a giant farty tree.
I'm so glad that studio had the opportunity to kind of correct Dark Souls 2 and actually put the full force of their budget and their talent behind a proper Dark Souls 1 sequel without the obvious constraints and conflicts that happened during the development process for that second game. And the result is something that's extremely polished and just full of astonishing areas, like entering a new area in that game, like the snowy city that you go to, remember?
You
just walk out of this cave and it's just absolutely astonishing.
A magic, deadly Christmas land.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's a good Christmas game, I think, actually. I might go back to that place and get destroyed all over again there.
And I think this is also because Bloodborne, I played as a purely atmospheric thing with Dark Souls 3. I was a little more comfortable treating it as like a daft multiplayer game sometimes. Sure, it totally works as like that.
Yeah, definitely.
And I signed up for Wolf Duty, whatever that's called, and get occasionally teleported into a forest just to kick the shit out of people and run away. And that's great. Yeah. And that's there's so many mad little interlocking co-op, competitive systems in that game that mean that when you enter an area that is protected by other players that can be called in to shoo you away from it, that's a real sort of fun mini thing in its own right.
They've really developed the NPCs and the ways that they can interact with you in Dark Souls 3.
Mm.
They're not just kind of stationary signposts who might appear in a future location if you happen to summon them in the right fight. They actually engage with you a lot more, and there's a particular character coming back from previous Dark Souls who you meet in a tower like about 6 or 7 hours in, and the way he kind of engages with you and kind of comes to fight by your side is far more organic in previous games. It feels much more like an exciting interaction with an NPC. And so a lot of the kind of storytelling beats that Dark Souls relies on, like there are some more sophisticated versions of those in Dark Souls 3, and that's kind of been a bit overlooked. And they've said they're going to move away from Dark Souls, but I think they like money, and so there will be a Dark Souls 4 probably in a couple of years. And I look forward to seeing how they develop it. They're going to have to kind of move it on a bit more, I think, because it felt a little bit stale.
Yeah, it certainly felt. It wasn't like Bloodborne.
No, but Bloodborne's sensational.
Yeah.
The best game I've played for ages. Still.
Let's move on to Tiltbrush, as I wrote down Tiltbrush on this list.
Tiltbrush. I like Tiltbrush.
Tiltbrush, one of yours, isn't it?
Pretty good. Yeah, I wanted to put something that I felt did VR in a way that wasn't tokenistic and that used the space in a really interesting way rather than... And you could say the same for something like Dota's spectator mode or something like that. I think that's genuinely doing some interesting things or, at least making use of the space. But so Tiltbrush is essentially an image creation tool in 3D space, and so what you're doing is you're treating the entire sort of room scale section of imaginary 3D space as your own sketchbook, and so you can just draw straight into the area in front of you and actually sketch out trees that you can walk around if you wanted to, or things that are sort of to scale, or you can fiddle around with scale. Like I tried doing like a mini cathedral and sort of feeling like a Hulk inside of it. And yeah, you can also see what real artists have done, in the medium as well. And so you sort of see these amazing parrots with glowing neon tails sitting on a branch, or, these wonderful sketched, like dancing shapes around you, and I think that that's part of the appeal. And I'd really like to go back in when we've got a Vive that has the base stations calibrated correctly.
We did for a while.
We did. I was busy with other things, so I couldn't sit down with it properly. But what I'd like to do is do something really sort of tiny and delicate, or as delicate as you can get with the way it's calibrated, and then just sort of hide it within things, because it makes use of the fact that you can jam your head into a box and sort of see the lines, I guess, that you've tried to hide with it. And I think that there's scope for actually experimenting with that, or making a snow globe that you can step inside physically. And I think that that kind of thing is just genuinely cool and transports you into a very different space, either in terms of the sense of scale or in terms of where you feel you are, or any of those things. And I think that the majority of the other stuff that I've found in VR hasn't had any of that power or potential. It's just been sort of, here's my idea of a thing to trick you into having a game experience slightly differently.
I talked to an engineer who worked on Tiltbrush, who was telling me that it was incredibly difficult to get it to run well, because it hadn't occurred to me at all, but like when you're in it, it just feels like, oh, this is like a paint program, but in full three dimensions. And so it just feels natural that you can do all this stuff. But until he said this, I hadn't thought about the fact that whatever you're drawing is basically like a bunch of polygons, and, you know, it has to be rendered the same way that a 3D environment is in a video game. Whereas when you draw on a canvas in a 2D thing, it's just kind of there. It's just like, it's in the memory now, and it's just being read in. Whereas in a 3D environment, not only does it have to be kind of stored in 3D, but also you're constantly seeing it from different angles. Every time you move your head in any way, there's no such thing as like a static perspective. You're always moving.
Yeah.
And so it's always having to like process it. Can you browse what other people have made sort of in the app?
There are tools that are like, so you can upload stuff, so you can share it, and you can also use tools on the, you know, the controller and stuff in game to create GIFs, you know, the ones that sort of tilt from side to side to actually show off the 3D-ness of a thing. And so, yeah, there are a lot of different ways. And I think Sketchfab has a way where you can, like, upload it and you can download other people's stuff. And like I say, it's got this gallery of, like, professionally created things that you can sort of download if you're just starting out and looking for inspiration. The one thing that I would say is it's one of those things which rewards what you or what other people put into it. So if you're not particularly artistically inclined, you can kind of see the cool potential of it, but you won't necessarily get any of the enjoyment. It will just be frustration and lines in a space that you can't get to grips with. And so I kind of get that it really won't be for everyone, but I think that, you know, it's one of the things that made me feel like something had shifted a bit, and I'm interested to see what other people do with it, you know, what they can then use those spaces for. So if you sketch out like a scene, can you then export that and use it for something, or could you put people in it and have them have an experience, or can you use it for, you know, showing people a plan for something even, or, you know.
I found that it didn't unlock any extra artistic talents in me, but I did find that handwriting in 3D is a totally new experience. I mean, incredibly like fluid and easy. My handwriting is terrible in 2D, or paper as we call it.
Whereas I wrote Tilt-Bursch.
the first thing I did when I got it working was I just had loads of problems getting it set up, and I couldn't figure it out, but my tracking was just going mad, and it hadn't been previously, and I didn't know what was going on. And then someone on Twitter replied to me to say, I had trouble when I had a mirror in my room. Once I covered that, it's fine.
I remember you saying.
And that was it. And once I covered it, it was perfect. And suddenly I'm in Tiltbrush and I can do stuff. And so the first thing I did in Tiltbrush was to write out in handwriting, holy fuck, it was the mirror, thanks! And it just looks way nicer than my normal handwriting.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's that thing of like, in art classes, sorry, that will make sense in a moment. In art classes.
And only if you're watching the video.
Oh, yeah. In art classes, they sort of, one of the things that you're often encouraged to do is to sort of, you know, move your whole arm as you paint. So you actually get fluid kind of strokes, or, you know, like when you're moving your pencil around. Because otherwise you sort of end up working little and, you know, sort of crabbed kind of drawings. Yeah. And, you know, otherwise you can actually do these expressive sweeps and make better use of the paper, and it doesn't feel so intimidatingly big. Which is kind of cool. I think you're more prone to do that when you're holding essentially a wand, you know?
I'm just waving my arms in big circles everywhere.
Also, it's like having a sparkler, you know?
Yeah, that's a good thing.
There's something really magical about that. And it feels like a real Disney moment when you just make light at the end of your hand, you just sort of do that and make spirals out of it. It's just really, really nice. Like,
or
really
when pleasurable. You can, because you can actually paint kind of snowfall into an area.
Yeah.
And so you just sort of like, you know, move your thing around and you've got the trigger held down and you just sort of watch as it starts.
Little particle effect comes down. Like, but in 3D, and it feels so just like you want to kind of waft it.
This should be a Fantasia VR game.
That'd be amazing.
You know, just one big Mickey just waving around.
Feels like basic animation would be good. Oh, it sounds like they've got some sort of movement systems in there. But from what you described, was it where they move around stuff?
Like, you can move around stuff, and it's like particle effects.
As particle, I said that's it. That's the sense.
I think so.
Like you can create a GIF that puts it in motion, so that it kind of describes the 3D a bit better in a 2D space.
I see. Be interesting to kind of tough. experience with the cannibal of maybe basic anomaly. But that guy you spoke to is going to hate me for even suggesting that someone should be able to animate things in that.
It's really interesting. Like, I wonder how far back you can go, actually. Because, like, one of the things in Photoshop is when you've done too many things, it can't remember far enough back, or it gets totally overloaded, or you've got too many layers, and it's like, mate, I just can't.
That shit tree you drew 2 hours ago is never going to get fixed now.
So, like, I'm kind of worried. But actually, all of the bits are marked individually, so you can kind of hover over it with your hand and then delete the thing.
Yeah. It's so elegant, and it just came so quickly to me. Like, the UI in your wrist on one hand and the paintbrush on the other. Really great. Yeah. Really great.
Mm.
I love it.
Top brush. Next, Overwatch.
Yeah.
This is probably on everyone's list, right?
Yeah.
Is it in the middle of everyone's list?
Yeah, it's in the middle.
Yeah.
I think because I know so many people who are so more into it than I am, I almost didn't think of it as something to put on my list, and I thought, wait, no, I had loads of really good, like, amazing experiences with Overwatch. And then I kind of called on it when I started to lose a lot. And really, it's like, it's so much like the arc of TF2, except compressed, where at first it just seems like so much fun and everything's so new to you that even dying is kind of fun. Like, it's just like, wow, like the first time Reinhardt does his charge thing on you and catches you, and even if he knocks you off a level or slams you to a wall and kills you, it's just kind of hilarious to see that happen. And then as time wears on, that loses its novelty if you're not the one doing it. Like, ultimately, I kind of stopped playing it because, like TF2, it's very much a game of coordination. And I don't know how to coordinate people, and I don't really like being ordered around by other people. And so my coordination is always going to be just either random or not there. And when you're fighting against an enemy who has slightly better coordination, either because through random chance or because they're actually trying, it's kind of hell. It's just like, you're being picked apart, you know why you're being picked apart, and there's nothing you can do about it, because I don't want to spend my time organizing strangers and trying to, like, yell at them or them yelling at me. And so that's always the breaking point for me, and that's kind of why I stopped playing TF2 eventually. And so this time I had all that same arc, but it was much faster because I already knew where I was going, and I knew what could more quickly identify why I wasn't enjoying it. But in that time, just discovering each class and discovering, like, you know, for each class that you eventually get into, the moment that it clicks is always like that run that you have where you get like 17 kills or something, and it just feels like the enemy can't do anything about you, and it's just so satisfying. And particularly for me, Tracer is the highlight. I probably have more good runs as D.Va, just because she's probably more useful in more situations in the games I've been in, but when Tracer works, when you're doing it right, it just feels totally unstoppable, and you're also really, really fragile, which kind of adds to the excitement of it. And her abilities are just such dick moves, basically. Mm. They're just so, like, tricksy, and, like, she can rewind time, and she can blink across gaps, and so you can move incredibly quickly, get into a terrible situation, and then immediately get back out of it. And while you're rewinding, no one can do anything to you, and so you're just kind of like, it actually reminds me more of the Dead Ringer in TF2, which is an item for the spy that lets you feign death. And as well as faking your death, like, as soon as someone hits you, a corpse comes out of you and you go invisible. And people know that happened. They know full well that you're faking your death, and they're, like, almost exactly where you are and you're invisible. But it also gives you, like, 90% damage reduction or something, so they can't really do anything about it. And Trace does that same thing where you just kind of, I know I'm going to get caught. I know you're going to see me doing this, but there's nothing you can do about it because I'm going to rewind time.
I think it deserves a lot of credit for making people really excited about a team shooter, particularly one that is so team play dependent, because you saw so many of them fail to, like, hold on to audiences, and yet Overwatch is sort of undoubtedly the biggest, like, community success of the year by such a long way. Like, it's the only game that, like, fundamentally, like, okay, there was a community for it, there were people crowing for the beta, but there wasn't, like, an Overwatch community in the same way that there is now at the start of the year, and then at the end of the year there is this hundreds of thousand person strong, kind of very passionate community of fans for that thing. And that didn't come from nowhere. I mean, I'd argue that it partly came from very savvy, very aggressive marketing, but at the same time they built this really accessible game that was easy to introduce people to, and that people could sort of have fun immediately, and it didn't necessarily matter if you weren't very good at shooting, which is a kind of a bold move for a shooter to take, to offer all these different ways to play. And I really loved it for a while. But now, like, it's sort of boiled down to just the things I really like about it, which is basically just Farah. Like, all I want to do is fly around with a jetpack and occasionally get, like, the big perfect you know, alt off and get a big play of the game. And that happened to me in my first game of Overwatch after it went live the night of release. So not my first game ever, but my first game on the live game. And that was probably the best one I've ever done. And that sort of maybe highlights the thing of, like, you know, similar to the that one death to Reinhardt being hilarious the first time, the luster wearing off. Now, however many months later, I feel like I've seen every scenario Overwatch can throw up, really. Mm. Like, so the game has become more about just sort of going through the motions and going by the playbook for each map before, you know, waiting to use your, you know, your ult and hoping that it's the one that gets picked for play of the game and whatever, and never really being surprised by things that happen. Like the first time McCree with Deadeye wipes out your team, that's a oh fuck moment. But the first time you use, I don't know, like Mercy's ult and bring your entire team back and that saves the game, that feels great. But I feel like there's not enough sort of systemic variety in its construction, in its kind of, you know, toolbox to mean that you're not kind of seeing the same scenarios over and over again, particularly as they've locked it down for balance reasons. So they've, you know, since then they have locked off, well, they've shunted the ability to pick more than one of the same hero off into its own mode. And that was something that I think gave a lot of, I know, I understand why they were so passionate about the game being that way when they first launched it, even though it didn't work out, because it meant that you'd have those games where you're like, oh shit, it's all Winstons. Yeah. And there's just an army of leaping gorilla men, like, sailing in over the level, and that felt so different. Or like the all diva rush where you fly around the side of the level. And the game has since lost that, become a lot more balanced. I think lost something of its potential to surprise as a result.
Mm.
So I play it a lot less now. And also, you know, the addition of ranked mode and people starting to take it seriously turned it into a different type of game tonally. It went from being quite a friendly game in the alpha and beta to being a game that I would argue is honestly more toxic than Dota. Like, on, substantially. Like, in one ranked game of Overwatch, you'll encounter, like, voice chat abuse, text abuse, and annoying emote spam slash in-game line abuse. And normally you have to, like, you have to pick one of them for Dota. Like, you know, get all three every time. So, yeah, unfortunately, you know, it's a beautiful toilet.
I really liked it for a few weeks, and then I kind of felt, yeah, I was done with it. And I think part of that is that I felt like I'd sort of seen what it had to offer, but also that I wasn't particularly making progress, so, you know, whatever. But I also didn't really... I don't really know how to exactly put it, but I just... It wasn't the... I don't quite know how what I'm trying to get at anymore.
Tom?
No.
Do you know what he's
going
to
say? What does this happen? Why does my brain just shut off?
Whiskey.
No, I've barely had any. This is water, essentially.
That means the whiskey's gone, Pip.
Yeah, but I only had a little.
Okay.
Which is why you should give me some more. So maybe I can remember. This is context sensitive or mood sensitive or body sensitive. Memory.
I see, yeah. Right, that makes sense. Overwatch.
Yeah, no, I had a point. It's completely gone out of my head.
What did you make of it, Tom? I'm interested
to know what you mean. I bounced right off it. I think I was one of the first people to see it at the first BlizzCon they ever revealed it.
Yeah, you were.
I went out to do a cover feature on it for PC Gamer. And I was very impressed by it. Like, aesthetically, I think they do what Blizzard do so well, but just kind of taking archetypes and shaping all the edges off them and presenting them as
spheres,
easily consumed, very bulbous, easily consumed content.
Butternut squash.
Yeah,
the game.
Like, here's a. It used to be a cowboy. Now it's a butternut squash, but one that you can sell to 16
year olds.
There's a very specific area of the Overwatch fandom.
I'm having my point. Come to me afterwards.
Okay.
Excellent. And I enjoyed the kind of fantasy of it, and I enjoyed how breezy it was, and the way that the aesthetic was attempting to create a kind of a friendly, fun, freefall shooter.
A friendly fun for all.
You could dip into just for 20 minutes and enjoy, which is what I used to do with TF2 all the time. Mm. I got so much joy out of that. But I found TF2 genuinely funny, and found its characters and world much more funny and engaging than Overwatch ended up being.
Mm.
And actually, I felt like Overwatch was a very empty game when I ended up actually starting to play it. And I didn't feel like I enjoyed being in that world or interacting with those systems very much as a result. It's almost like an aesthetic thing that I bounced off more than a design thing.
Mm-hmm. Itself. Mm. We've talked plenty about how big missed opportunity the short films represent, because they're pretty terrible given how well produced they are. Like, the scripts are awful and no one cares.
Yeah, it's sad really, because there's so much extraordinary kind of cinematic creation talent at Blizzard. Like, their Diablo 3 cinematics are always just kind of amazing. Really sumptuous, just really...
But it's amazing shouty nonsense.
Yeah, yeah, but very kind of unknowing of its tone. Like, the Diablo cinematics always very much understood what they were going for, because they've been doing it for God knows how long with that series, whereas Overwatch, they're trying to create something new, and they're just not as funny as what people like Valve are producing. So maybe from a press perspective, they just don't have the sense of humour that really... Like, they do have a sense of humour, but it's not, like... It's not the delight. It's not the delight to it. That
they seem to have worked for... Like, they must have been going for something specific, and it's worked for a whole load of my friends who didn't give a shit about TF2.
Right.
And I would say, like, TF2 shorts are not only... great, but like exceptionally great for even given how good TF2 is. Like, they're unusually great in a whole different way.
Yeah, yeah.
And for Overwatch, I feel like they completely fall flat. And yet, TF2 just didn't catch on with a whole bunch of my friends who just not only love Overwatch, but specifically love the characters and love those shorts and get really into them and like start writing like little bits of fan fiction, like in a kind of jokey way, but like really care about who these people are and like imagining their lives and how they feel about each other and stuff.
So, Blizzard have access to this secret sauce, evidently, that I've just like not really...
Yeah, I don't
know. None of us have a taste for it.
Yeah, so it's just it's an interesting thing, isn't it?
I mean, they are much more colourful characters. They get to, like, there's some women in there, for example. So yeah. If you had none
that, yeah, that's good.
And they get to kind of have their own style in a way that like, in TF2, they can only really have physique, and they all had, all the red guys had to wear red, and all the blue guys had to wear blue.
Right.
And they did get a lot of style within that, but it was quite a tight restriction to work in. It's a bunch of military men wearing red was the genre that they were working in. So what was your thing?
I was going to say, I think one of the reasons that I bounced off it eventually, like after maybe a week or two, was that I found it very, very difficult to feel like I was making an impact on the game, like a positive impact. Partly because of the characters that I choose to play. So I play supports and I play, you know, the healers and things like that. And so you never get play of the game that way. Like, I would do, like, the best Zarya Graviton thing of my life, and this became a running joke.
And then I would get prey of the game.
All of the kills, yeah. And it would just be like, okay, well...
They did fix that, to a greater or lesser extent.
But it was after I'd lost interest, because I was like, well, I'm not getting rewarded even when I do something really cool. Like, the screen at the end would rarely have, like, oh, you know, you prevented this amount of damage from hitting your team. That's not going to get ticks. It's going to be so-and-so's kill streak, isn't it? So so it was things like that. And so I kind of felt like I was very aware when people were killing me or when I wasn't making an impact. But when I was playing well, it didn't feel like it really mattered a lot of the time. It was only when I was on voice comms with friends and they'd be like, oh, that was great, or like, oh, that really helped set me up for a thing. You don't really get any feedback otherwise. It felt like when I was playing more of it than none. But now I'm kind of into it in the way that I don't think I would ever be afraid to go back to it. Like, if somebody was like, oh, it's the only game I have on my PC, so can we play this evening? Then I don't think I'd ever struggle to get back into it. I think they've got that accessibility thing down.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot that does draw me in. And you said about the secret sauce. I think a lot of the people who don't like their short films, I get the feeling that a lot of us think that it's, that it's because often they feel derivative or they feel shallow or whatever else. But I think the people that do like it, it's kind of because they do write the characters so large. And so, you know, one person's, it's boring and derivative, is another person's, oh, that's so cute, or that's... And that's not to say that, like, I'm right being a snob or that they're right you know, because they're less cynical, you know, things like that. It's more just that it's the different taste that it leaves.
My friend Tom Mayo describes it, Blizzard style, as generic cool. Generic, but it's kind of cool for me.
Yeah.
That sounds like a sort of dystopian fashion.
But like you know, the PTSD...
Robot. Yeah.
Bastion. That felt like they've watched what Pixar do and sort of have picked out the core beats of those stories. And like, I actually didn't mind that at all. But it felt like I was watching a version of a thing that I know better or that does it better or that can still surprise me. Like, that story was never going to surprise me. But then when I went to see whatever Pixar movie it was that was fairly recent and it had that Sandpiper, like, short at the beginning, that was adorable.
Yeah.
That was, like, the best thing.
I think that's the thing with Blizzard is their technical ability is amazing and their design, you know, the brilliant game designers. But when it comes to narrative and to some extent visual design, they don't seem to be able, as you know, specifically in narrative and writing, they don't seem to be able, have the ability to do something original. Like, everything is really heavily derived from some sort of form that's been laid out for them by somebody else. So
I thought that the Sombra stuff came closest to stepping outside of that, and she did seem to have her own personality, but then they booped.
Yeah.
And then it's all about the boop, and the other stuff just...
Could be more to it than the boop. It's all about the boop.
It's all about that boop.
But what I'm saying is that even the Sombra stuff, right, like, in terms of the... I don't know. If you read, like, quite naff comic books, you have encountered everything they're ever going to do within that universe. And obviously that's a bit of a profound shame. Not to poop on it. I mean, I think we've all adequately explained why Overwatch is in the bottom half of all of our... I think we maybe dwelled a little bit too much on its failings. But and then certainly the movies aren't.
Tracer's really good.
Far is great. It's, you know, it's a fun game. I'll
never not be able to go back to it, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely a perennial, but I think I found myself more and more going, like, I'd like to play something else.
Yeah.
Titanfall 2.
Something else, like, for example, Deus Ex Mankind Divided.
Yes.
Hello?
That is a game that came out last week because someone asked about games that have been overshadowed. And it really did, like, it's funny that it's so close to Human Revolution. Human Revolution is not only, like, one of my favourite games of all time, it also, if you'd ask me, like, do you prefer Dishonored or Deus Ex Human Revolution? Like, of course, Deus Ex Human Revolution. Like, by far, it's not even close. And yet, Dishonored 2 is really like Dishonored, and Deus Ex Mankind Divided is really like Human Revolution, and I dramatically prefer Dishonored 2. And Mankind Divided kind of, to some extent, the fact that it doesn't move it forwards very much hurts it, but mostly it's just that... damn it, we're going to spend the whole time talking about why it's not great. Let's talk about why it is great.
Okay, let's talk about why it's great. Then maybe we can fit in some... But this is why, because we can talk about why Dishonored 2 is great when we get to Dishonored 2, which, spoilers, is on this list.
Not from me.
It is, the actual level design, I think, is even better than Human Revolution, and it just, like, goes absolutely to town on the multipath idea. It's just, like, once you're actually out in a kind of combat space, there it's so rich with little vents and high routes and low routes and all that stuff, and it's all set within just spectacular places. The art direction is even better, and it's just a gorgeous place. The bank is amazing to look at. I think the bank is kind of a special case, actually, because then I also want to talk about Gollum City, which is the first place you kind of go to from Prague, like your first kind of away mission, I guess. And that is visually beautiful, and that's the one I'm thinking of when I'm talking about, like, how dense all the networks of routes you can take are. And it's mostly a combat space. So there's a little, like, town at the start, I guess. And then you go off into just the guts of this kind of, like, junkyard slash, I don't even know how to describe it, but, like, a hugely vertical city made out of often junk and often, like, cargo containers and stuff like that. But then the bank in Prague is the hub, the only hub, and you keep going back to it, and it's huge. But and bank became just this kind of, like, level It is a level of combat if you choose to try and steal from a bank, in which case the cops are your enemies. If you don't try and like break into it, then it's a pretty boring place. You just kind of, I think reception is about the only place you can go to, and maybe you can get like an appointment with a manager or something. But I found I was just going there every time I was in Prague. There are missions there, but for the most part, it was of my own volition. I had read a data cube somewhere that told me about something in Vault 1 that sounded valuable. And so I was trying to break into Vault 1, and my quest to break into Vault 1 took about 3 hours, during the course of which I broke into everything in Vault 2, completely ransacked the place. I raided all 5 floors of the bank, knocked out nearly every guard in the whole place, found every key card, everything, and still couldn't break into Vault 1. And then finally got into that like much later, and then came back there for a mission. I can't remember, when you come back there for a mission, does it like respawn guards or anything, or is it just all already cleaned out?
Yeah, all the kind of openings you've created are still there, even if the guards repopulate. I'm not sure if I killed pretty much all of them, so they stay dead, as far as I know.
I had a really great moment in one of the vaults where I realised I could use see-through vision to just to see what was in this room before I tried to figure out a way to break into it. And then by doing that, I could find a panel in there that controls the window to make it transparent instead of opaque. And I have remote hacking, and remote hacking, you can hack anything you can see. And even though the window's opaque at the moment, I can see through it because I have X-ray vision. And so I used X-ray vision and remote hacking to hack the panel that would then turn the window transparent. And then I could see properly into the room and like figure out where I was going to go from there. And that was a really cool thing of like power stacking and figuring out combinations of your abilities. But the story just really didn't get from me. To the point where I just couldn't focus on it. People would say stuff, and then I'd hit the, I can't remember if I said this, but I would hit the shadow play button to record the last 5 minutes, then I'd all come out and watch the video back to find out what the hell they just said. And even then, I couldn't really absorb it. It all felt so abstract and so far away from what's going on, and I didn't know what the groups represented and what they were trying to do and why I was involved. And
can I just say, this is my experience with most games, because my memory is so bad. So if I'm reviewing something, I'll make notes as I go, or like I'll, you know, screenshot things and bits of dialogue just so that I do not forget it. But with movies or something, this is just me the entire time. I'm like, can't tell you, mate. Could not tell you.
I think for me it's not memory, it's just whether I care about the thing. If you tell me something that's really compelling, like there's a side quest where you're investigating a murder, and just because it's a murder, I'm interested. And so I remembered all the details of that, and I knew what was going on all the way through. And I didn't think it was an amazing side quest, but I was engaged with it the whole way through, and I understood everything that was happening, because it was just a compelling story, on a really basic level. I wasn't doing that original, it was very conventional. And that's what the main plot failed to do for me, is it just didn't click on any level. Which is like not the hugest problem with immersive sim, because I also don't really care that much about, I don't know. I get into Dishonored fiction, but the main story, sort of the plot beats, don't really do that much for me. But I think, without really realizing it, I think in Human Revolution the thrust of the story was like, I wasn't thinking about it that much, but it was adding something, and once you take that away, it really takes away the momentum, I think.
Mm-hmm. The difference, I think, like, there aren't any good characters in New Deus Ex game. Like, even Jensen is just a total kind of non-entity. Like, I don't understand why he's invested in what he's doing or what he wants or why he's really there. Everyone you meet is kind of, you know, just a really, you don't really get to know any of them. Like, the people who you're spending a lot of time with, like, you're fucking commanding officer man who's an idiot and has a really terrible voice acting on him.
Yeah,
which is really grating and irritating. So I think it's just like a total lack of characters that you can even give a shit about, whereas Dishonored is full of, you know, even if you they've got bad guys, they're still really interesting. Like the guy who's built this Clockwork Mansion is still like a really interesting character, and you know, you might want to spare him or not. The people who you kind of gather onto your boat are really interesting, and we'll talk about this more later. But I think that's such a key difference to not have anything to latch onto, any sort of glimmer of humanity in any of those characters. And to have, it was such a kind of po-faced story about apartheid without ever actually really confronting any of those issues with any
that part, they really felt like they went out of their way to make that comparison even when it didn't really apply, and that felt really awkward.
Didn't quite work for it, but I agree. I love the level design.
I feel like there's the seed of a great story in there, because I found myself quite engaged in the loading screens. It summarized the plot, and reading it in summary form was like, oh okay, I'm a double agent working for Interpol, that's interesting. But in the game that didn't come across, and so I feel like they're and never just started like one chapter later and you were just showing up for your first day at work at Interpol and then you clock off and you meet your contact in a cafe and she, and that's the scene that reveals to the player, but Jensen already knows, that he's a double agent and he's, you know, supposed to be spying on his boss, and that would be a really compelling opening and I would probably be with it from there. I feel like plot is not so much about like shocking developments and, oh, I can't wait to hear what happens next. It's much more about the fantasy, like who am I and what is this life I'm leading? Mm. And if that's interesting, I'm engaged, even if, you know, what's happening in the plot doesn't make any sense.
In my head, he's augmented, but in the sense that he's part hedgehog. Because every time I look at him, I'm just like, what a hedgehog would look like if it came man for a day, you know?
In secret Sonic sequence.
In what way?
His hair and his general demeanour.
His demeanour?
With the sunglasses on or off?
Well, it's more the hair.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, once they're on, they're kind of like, there's something, like, insecty about them.
Yeah, like, there's a beadiness, I guess. For
just like
a,
hedgehogs.
I don't know, I think of him as a hedgehogman.
It'd be great if when his sunglasses activated, his hair also spiked up a little bit.
That would be good. Really, or he flat. Could, like, injure people by backing into them, you
he
know?
He does have spikes on his arm.
Does he crawl into bonfires before they're lit?
You got to check your fireworks night bonfire for Jensen's. In this holiday season, be sure to give him a good old rummage. Make sure he's not sleeping in there.
He might be cloaked, remember.
Does he cross the road at really inappropriate times?
Yeah, exactly. There's a few little Jensens that sing about crossing the road.
Be sure to EMP your bonfire to deactivate his cloak so you can find him before you set fire to it. Actually, he puts on a Titan shield, which is kind of like a spiky defense thing.
You see, and I think the black and gold color palette kind of helps.
I've never seen this. I've never seen a bionic black and gold hedgehog. He's some sort of military.
Imagine it would be Adam Jensen.
You would easily confuse that for a gaming mouse.
Ah,
it's a tiny Adam Jensen.
You see. And that's why I
what do you mean by demeanour?
Is
it the brooding, the alcoholism that you associate with hedgehogs?
Because I haven't played it. I've only really seen the screenshots.
I couldn't tell.
And also, like, the preview stuff that they had at E3, maybe? And so I don't know. I just, you know, you get a feeling for the spirit animal of someone.
No.
Okay. You know, like, I don't know. You just sort of think if you were an animal, you'd be this animal. Not in the sense of a
what
spirit animal in that they're like providing any kind of guidance or, like,
yeah.
I don't know. What
animals would we be?
I don't know. You'd probably be like an ermine of some kind, you know. Like
what is that? Like a stoat?
It's like a winter stoat.
A winter stoat.
Yeah, you know. It'd be fine.
What would Tom be?
Like, I haven't had a lot of time with this. With this as an idea.
Also a hedgehog.
You know? Well, I think I've gone full woodland, because I think maybe, you know, like, the mole with the dark hair, you know? Because the face, you've got the sleek
kind
of... Because
the face. You know, that face thing you've got going.
You know, you've got a...
The blindness.
Well,
my tendency to burrow.
But well, you know what I mean?
No, bang on,
there's
really.
A kind of... I was going to say velvety, but that comes up as weird.
How did we get
here? You know, there's a snug. I don't know. Like, I don't know how to explain this, because every time you do, it just makes you sound like a weirdo. It's just you get a feeling of an animal for somebody. That's all.
And Chris?
I don't know.
Some as yet undiscovered species.
I've just looked at you for too long, you know? Like, your face is just really familiar. Like, I'm not doing any kind of free association. I see these guys relatively infrequently, and so, you know, I see them anew.
The animal is strong.
You know, I get, like, a sense of this. You're not... this isn't offensive. Because I was going to say, if I sit there and say that someone reminds me of some kind of ferret and some kind of mole, I mean, I don't think that comes across very well for anyone, but... You know, they're in a nice way, like, they're nice creatures, and I really like them, and they're really interesting, and they do interesting.
I'm happy with my loss, to be honest, with this.
Well, yeah, I'm good with them.
Yeah.
I've already
warm,
seen them.
That's more what I meant, like, that kind
more
of velvety
warm.
Snugness that's just a friendly, warm kind of... What? Don't tell me this didn't happen last year.
I think we're at one-tenth of the way through the list.
And that is mankind divided.
Believe it or not.
I feel like that went wrong.
No, I mean, I think we all learned something. The next game on the list, I don't know if I can really segue out of that.
I don't think it's worth trying.
Okay. The next game that I'm going to go to on the list is Steven's Sausage Roll. Hailed by many as the greatest game ever made when it came out.
I've not played it. I know nothing about it.
It's a game about pushing a sausage. Right. Yeah, I mean, it's very good.
You've got to roll that sausage specifically. You are a character who's... you're one by one on the grid, but your fork that you carry extends from you also one space. So you're effectively one by two, which means you can't turn around in tight corridors or tight spaces. Mm-hmm. And if you walk into a sausage fork first, you skewer that sausage. You can also just prod it.
You push it forward, but if it is against... You've got to brace the sausage to skewer it,
as they say. Mm. And so it's just a really, like... I would say... fiddly at times, game about nudging sausages around a grid in order to roll them onto grills, and you must cook, a sausage is also 2x1, and you must cook every part of its underside and then every part of its other side,
for a total of four squares
of sausage to be cooked, but you also mustn't cook any one square twice. If it's already on a grill and then it rolls onto a grill again, it will get burnt.
Fucked it.
As soon as you burn any sausage, exactly, fucked it. If you burn the sausage, you fucked it. If you push the sausage into the sea, you fucked it.
Right.
Both cases, you've got to restart.
Typical Bob-esque etiquette.
If you've managed to, like, shove your sausage into a corner, you fucked it again.
Yeah.
It's also possible to get a sausage stuck perpetually in your head in such a way that you can never come off again.
Really,
like,
super fucked it.
Yeah.
That was the level at which I gave up when I got a sausage just permanently stuck in my head and I could never nudge it off.
Yeah, it was
really
unsettling. The other day and you were just like not having it.
That's an amazing sentence.
Because you're 2x1 and the sausage is 2x1, like the fork, you can't move your fork. So it's just completely
and
entirely
pleasure. I just wandered around the level like that for a while.
I just stared out to sea for a while and then quietly reset the game.
I live like this now.
Yeah.
It is, it's a very clever game in that it, doesn't unlock abilities. You just go to new levels where things you didn't previously realize become important, like skewering sausages. You just can't do it on the first like 5 levels because there are no walls against which to brace a sausage. And so the first time a wall appears, you discover, oh, if I walk into it with my fork out, it actually like skewers it. And then you discover all these rules about once it's skewered, you've got to kind of hook it over something and then walk backwards to pull it off your fork. You can't sort of manually eject the sausage from your fork.
You also learn little, like, not exactly workarounds, but like, so I think, I can't remember quite the mechanics of it, but I think it's something like, if you are standing with a pillar like to your left or something and you try to turn, you can't physically turn, but your fork will still nudge the sausage if the sausage is like behind the pillar. So you still get to do the pivoting action, even though it looks like it might be physically impossible. So there are little bits of wiggle room that slowly kind of come out as being part of how you solve these things when they initially look impossible. But sometimes you are just bashing your head against a wall with it for long.
As a puzzle game, it's not one of those things where there's like loads of different solutions to each puzzle. It's extremely strict and it's trying to teach you something. And there's one thing you have to understand to be able to do this puzzle, to the point where I actually solved a couple because I just by looking at them when I was stuck and thinking, well, my current solution doesn't use this bit of land that sticks out from the right. And that, knowing Stephen, there is no way you put that for no reason. There has to be some reason you have to go there or use it, or something has to be on that piece of land. So if I have a solution that doesn't involve it, it's wrong. There must be something that doesn't involve
it. It's interesting that you say that it's like that each of these things is trying to teach you something. I find that it's a game which teaches you nothing. Like, you have to work for it. It's like, for me, it's the opposite of The Witness, with its, like, drip-feeding you the solutions to the puzzles by making you work through progressively difficult, more difficult examples. This is just like, well, here's the puzzle, good luck with that, I'm off.
Yeah, when I first played it, I literally couldn't solve any puzzles at all. Doesn't lead you in particularly gently. There's no introductory puzzles where it teaches you the basic movement or anything. So I just didn't know anything about what even a solution looked like. Like, just anything to kind of start with. And the puzzle is difficult. And so you don't know whether you're failing to solve the puzzle or failing to understand the movement mechanics or, really basic stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was actually really glad I looked up, like, the solution to the first two or something. And then once I'd seen two solutions, I'm like, okay, I understand. It's about rolling sausages on, and these are the moves. Like, the moves I already knew were the ones that were used in the solution, and it was just about finding a way to solve the puzzle. And once I knew that, I'm like, okay, I can focus on that now, and I don't have to worry about, is there a button I don't know about? Is there?
Yeah. I think I really like it for similar reasons that some people really get off on Dark Souls games. You know, it's like
it's people the Dark Souls really, sausages.
Well, people really, really love that kind of unforgivingness, or that it's, you know, you bash your head against something repeatedly and then you suddenly realise the solution or the way around this particular thing or the trick to it, you know? And that this, I feel like, is the puzzle equivalent of that. And I would say I prefer it to The Witness because I have never felt as stupid or as smart as I have in such a tiny space of time. Like, you know, the absolute kind of joy of completing this one level that you've been stuck on for not even hours, you know, maybe days, weeks, months, and then you suddenly get through it and you are the smartest person in the entire universe, and then you remember that there's like 8 other puzzles currently accessible to you, there's extra islands, there's like whole like reams of puzzles ahead of you, and you just kind of go, I'm going for a cup of tea now. So, I don't know, I really admire that in it, and it's, yeah, like, I know that a lot of people didn't like it and thought that, you know, I think the aesthetic was off-putting to a lot of people because it was really low kind of poly kind of style. And I just really, really loved it. Really loved it.
Top sausage. Sausage of the year. We're going to have to pick up the pace on each game. I hate to say to everybody, because what are we on? Over an hour?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. We've been recording for over an hour. We've gotten through maybe 10% of the list.
Shall we take a break at an hour and a half, even if we're not through this, and then come back to it afterwards?
Yes, that makes sense, because we'll have a smaller audience participatory bit.
Okay.
But yeah, so new way we're going to do this. New way we're going to survive this collectively, and including all of us in that, including you listening, is by maybe just saying what we like about each one. And then moving on to the next one. Because otherwise, we're fucked.
It's going to be forever.
Yeah. So, little cheeky appearance here by Dota 2. That's not valid for the list, you might say, if you were not me or Pip.
Hello.
But
I put that on. Yeah. You can't blame Chris.
No, but I do agree, and I can probably introduce why. And it's because, for a few reasons, Dota has had like an absolutely amazing year. It's, I think, easily been the most interesting esport this year. All of its best events have been this year. Incredibly competitive.
And one of its worst.
But they were spectacularly bad in the Shanghai Major. But it's been a year of like a really amazing underdog stories. Like, it's not stabilised at all, which is kind of impressive for a game like that. Like, the every tournament has been won by a team that... And I know this as somebody who commissions articles about who's likely to win things for a living. Every tournament has been won by a team that someone's gone, they're interesting, but they're not going to go very far, including me in one case. And that's been incredible to watch. And,
I don't know, like OG have.
But OG were complete unknowns only a year ago.
That's very.
I mean, not unknowns as players, but they were a new team that no one expected anything from.
Yeah, that's fair. And they're in a different lineup now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think to add to that, I mean, the reason that I put Dota 2 on the list is partly because it has been an absolute joy to watch in terms of professional gaming. Like, the International was amazing this year. They seem to have really found their footing with the majors. There have just been some spectacular moments in games, like game 3 of the final of the Boston Major. Some of the best, sort of most heart-stopping, ridiculous Dota that I've seen.
The only reason it's not the best game ever is the fact that there were 2 games better than it at the International, which is fucking nuts.
And so, like, that whole thing has been wonderful. And then it still manages to reinvent itself, or not reinvent itself, but its developer and other people who work on the game do manage to just absolutely pull the rug out from under you, as we saw this weekend.
Today.
With patch 7.0 coming out, and it's essentially rebuilt a whole bunch of the game. It's changed the map pretty much entirely. It has you know, added a new hero. It has, you know, introduced whole new ways of doing things, of interacting, of, you know, like the whole thing is different.
Yeah, so the short version of it is the reason we can put Dota on this list is because Dota 3 came out today. Like, I mean, it's the biggest update in a decade. Like, it's the reason they've done a full version update rather than an increment, because they've gone from 6.88 to 7, because it's such a huge deal. And, like, the game's never been more accessible than it is now. They've made huge changes. They've redone the entire UI, redone the map, redone leveling, redone how hero selection works and what you can do before a game. So I think it deserves space on the list, even though there's probably someone writing an angry letter right now. But yeah, no, seriously, like, what they've done to it just today is, this patch that was announced yesterday is absolutely extraordinary.
But in terms of all of the living games, it is still so exciting to watch.
Yeah, and it's easily the best eSport by a million miles.
I disagree for some moments, but I mean,
it's been consistently
amazing.
That brings us on to Inside, which I spoke a little about last week, which is the small boy run sideways, and it's a bit sad, I'm up for 2016. I liked it a lot for its atmosphere, lovely puzzle design, great ending, fantastic sort of sense, fantastic animation throughout, really great set pieces, its ability to pick up an idea, play with it for a bit and put it back down again.
I liked its humour as well.
I think it was gorgeous and like beautifully made and sort of captivating in its mysterious sort of wordless fiction that made me really fascinated to know more about this world and how it worked, but in a way that didn't make me frustrated when I didn't get like hard and fast answers to those things. I kind of wanted to just be intrigued by it. And most of that is also true of Limbo. And I think that sort of design and the world building was better here, but then also that last section, which I won't say anything about, but just, just completely stunned me. It was just like, one of the most surprising changes in a game, I would say, experience. And just, it's bizarre, it's creepy, it's funny. It's just so, the whole time I was just thinking, I can't believe they've done this.
Definitely worth like the 3 hours it'll take you to run through the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's totally worth catching up on, because I'm very glad I did. Next on the list, Sunless Sea, Zub-Mariner. Definitely a Pip game.
It
takes place in the sea.
Indeed. But it takes place under the sea. So, essentially,
everything's better down where it's meta.
Oh, Lord. So, I'm actually not as into the specific bits that Zub-Mariner necessarily added. What I really love about it is that it kind of gave me a reason to start playing Sunless Sea at all. Because it had kind of, I know it had annoyed people in different ways because of the combat loops and things like that. And so I kind of had not really got to grips with it, and I'd resented the fact that you have to build up to going out. Like, I'd wanted, when I first played it, an exploration experience, and I'd wanted more story, and I kind of didn't have the patience to sort of sit through those loops. And then when Zub-Mariner came out, I don't know whether it was just me being in a different mind space or whether the promise of under the sea was somehow more tantalising and made me want to work through the glitches, or maybe that over the course of the game's lifetime to that point they'd ironed out some of the problems. But I just, it gave me a reminder that that game existed. It gave me an extra sort of concrete thing to work towards that I couldn't have right away. And it also just, like, gave me a lot of really cool narrative experiences that I really enjoyed picking through and having the sense of. And so it's one of those things where the DLC wasn't exactly the point of it for me. It was more that it retroactively opened that initial game up for me.
Looking forward to Sunless Stars, because I think with having like multiple havens, it feels like you might have more the choice about how long you want those those loops to be. We had to
I was reading the dev blog because it was about how you don't have a home anymore. You have like, so Sun the Skies has, you have like major ports rather than a home port like you had with Fallen London, and so you can go back to any of them rather than have to make this journey back to this very specific point from maybe the other side of the map.
Get past the same scenery over and over again, which is like beautifully drawn, but the same. And
or like cycling through it, or trying to work out which stops to save up just so you've got something to do on the way back.
Yeah, it's kind of all that stuff.
Perhaps a game for 2017. next, we have... Well, let's stick with the ocean theme. And go to Burly Men at Sea.
That's another one of mine. Has anyone else played it?
No.
Nope.
Oh, okay. It's just a glorious, charming little storybook of a game. And I would really love to like play it through with my little niece at some point and just sort of have her like follow these little adventures and get to pick, you know, the ones that she wants to have that particular day. Because essentially you are going through the same core loop each time, as in you head out to sea and you like, you know, can go through particular chains of events, but there's enough variation within that that it still feels like you can refresh it every now and again, or you know, like I would happily go back to it and just pick my way through some familiar stuff and sort of some stuff that I by now don't really remember very well and kind of go, oh, I've forgotten that that thing can happen or that that character can exist or, you know, all of those kinds of things. And I think that it's just this gently wonderful thing that I really love and that is little and family friendly and so beautifully illustrated.
Nice. And about Burly Men at Sea.
Indeed, the brother's beard.
Fantastic. Top beard. Next, in the ocean. Subnautica.
Are we just rattling through my sea theme?
I thought it might be weird to keep returning to the sea between other games so that we could do the sea in a block.
This is just the aquarium portion.
Yeah.
The Crystal Maze?
The ocean zone.
Yeah. Subnautica is still in early access. It's fucking great. And that's where I would live if I could.
I've not seen you really take to a game like that this year. I mean, I've seen you take to games.
Yeah, but thousands of screenshots of that. Thousands of them. Got my base. Love my base. Haven't been back to it for a few updates just because I don't want to have to rebuild my base. And sort of...
Great pink submarine.
Thanks. Like, I keep tabs on it, like the whole thing. But It has such a wonderful sense of place. It has, like, it really rewards you kind of working your way up to exploration and finding, like, these weird, like, pallid things growing out of tiny, like, underground or, you know, these really dark, really deep caves, and these plants look like feet and, you know, like, hands or whatever, and then you've got like these vines growing sort of alongside them, but they seem to be like oozing droplets of blood that you can then harvest.
Is this a dream you had?
Sounds like my old flat.
Or the one we lived.
Yes,
it does.
Quite similar. Yeah. That kind of, horror of the deep.
But yeah, you know. There definitely was a lot of that going on, wasn't there?
But then you've also got the shallows where, like, the water kind of causticks are sort of shimmering across the sand, and you've got these beautiful corals and, like, this wonderful sort of vibrant palette of...
I'm really glad we're videoing this episode. So
I don't know what this is. It's essentially me doing, like, the hand mime constantly of what's this, a dead one of these, you know, like, just the whole time is that.
Yeah. A coral claw.
Changed what I thought about this game. So I thought it was a horror game where horrible toothy things attack you underwater.
There is... Narcosis is one of them.
Maybe I'll get
into that. There are... It's not a nice game in a lot of ways. Like, these toothed creatures will come and, like, bite at you or whatever. But if they come and bite my submarine, then I can harvest their teeth. Wow. Because their teeth will, like, fall off.
I'm fine.
So, I mean, the ship might get a bit damaged and I'll have to, like, repair it and whatnot. But, you know, so there's a certain amount of peril and you can't just go swanning about in the sea. Unless you
as swans or want to do.
Yeah, but they could break your arm, so they'd be fine. They're, you know, like if a swan came at me in my submarine, I'd probably be a bit worried. More worried because
the submarine has no arms.
That's true. If you had a periscope, do you think a swan could like fuck it up?
Break this motherfucker! Squawk. Yeah, fuck swans.
Yeah.
Especially
sea swans. Fuck swans.
Fuck sea swans.
Cool.
Love Subnautica. Best game.
That's your tattoo. Fuck swans. Love Subnautica.
Essentially, everything that was under the sea was great, except Abzu, which I kind of just couldn't seem to warm to. I mean, it was lovely and beautiful, but I just couldn't.
Is it the two mainstream undersea adventure option for 2016?
I think I had my underwater fix from other places, and so I was less reliant on Abzu for a good old saline kick
I got
to
more,
the face.
More out of pictures.
What? Is that a sex thing?
No. Let's move the fuck
saline on. Saline kick to the face is not a sex thing.
But he was giving me the look, like I just said something
said,
untoward.
If you type it into Urban Dictionary, Urban Dictionary is not going to give you nothing. It'll always, always be someone who's thought of it.
Okay. But that is... You were doing the look.
We're moving on. We are definitely moving on.
Okay. We'll talk about this later.
Are we leaving the ocean?
We're going to hell, Tom.
Exciting.
Are we?
And also, let's talk about Devil Daggers. I feel completely ashamed that I thought this was last year. This was definitely a surprise when it was on Graham's list, and I realised that I had missed it off all of my lists for all the PC gamer stuff and everything else, which was a terrible fucking mistake because it genuinely is one of the worst things.
Yeah.
And Graham touched off a lot of the good, you know, a lot of things I would say about it. It was to this year what, you know, Super Hexagon might have been to 2012. You know, like these kind of like perfect short form, highly lethal score attack, time attack games.
Kind of burst play games where you just do it for a
minute. This time applied to Quake, basically, but with the most incredible sound, really, and visuals. And not incredible as in high res, incredible as in just every like pixely skull. It is a game of pixely skulls, but they are perfect. And the lighting and the sense of threat and how much of the game relies on you intuiting where the danger is coming on from just from the sound it makes, which are these sort of like crackly midi cackles and laughs and the skittering of a skull spider in the darkness. That's my hand gesture for that, by the way.
It's a dead one of these.
It's undead though, so it's this sideways. Neither one realm nor t'other. But no, it's fabulous. It's so good. And the it's a game that I'm always happy to dip back into just because it's so kind of honed and you never really forget it. Like the skills you develop just by repeating and repeating and repeating. It's like riding a bike in hell.
Riding a bike made of bones.
Yeah, through a skull spider.
We went through a phase at RPS where like I'd see Alice logging on for like a few seconds, you know, from maybe a minute or two on Steam in between news articles, or I'd be like, Adam's just logged in. Oh, Graham, you're in there, are you? And so they ended up getting good, which I regretted when we did the RPS sports day.
If only there was someone who could step in to be, to help.
Unfortunately, Alice had you on her friends list and saw that you changed your name.
I changed my name to Pip. And
definitely Pip. That was just to really have
that name. I don't know how I saw through that.
Yeah. I know.
It's good. It's basically perfect. I don't know what you'd do to it to make it more kind of deliver what it was trying to do.
Why isn't it like people's game of the year?
Because partly because Dishonored 2 exists, but also because I thought it came out last
year. But you know what I mean? Like, I've seen people sort of talking about it, and like, so often they'll say, oh, it's this, you know, like you say, like this perfect kind of thing in terms of what it is for and what it does and the itches that it scratches. And then it doesn't seem to, that perfectness doesn't seem to push it higher up on there.
I think it's also like how you make something perfect, because you keep your scope small enough that the itch you're trying to scratch is very specific and you're just going to scratch that one thing and you're not going to try the open world or have levels and...
Yeah, the moment you have a story to Devil Daggers, you fucked it.
And that also explains why it's not where it doesn't become the be-all and end-all for everyone? Like, you want other things?
It's an interesting question, because, you know, in terms of, like, making... You know, if it was fewest mistakes made of the year, it would definitely win that, because... But because they have... It's not even that they've not aimed high, it's just that they've aimed specific.
Mm.
And it's always tempting to award stuff that is probably on the whole more impressive in that it is trying to do loads of different things and it succeeds at a remarkable number of them. Which, given that Dishonored 2 is the next game on this list, we might as well move on to for that reason, which is that, you know, I think, Tom, you and I sat for 3 hours and talked about this game all the way through from start to finish in the spoiler cast. But I think my closing note on it would be, for a game of that scope that is being a 10, 12 hour on the surface, I mean 20 hour if you keep, you know, if you really pay it, you know, a thorough adventure game with multiple approaches and stuff, it gets so much right. From the visual design to the writing to the audio to the level design to the really important stuff which bounces off level design, like power design and the AI and the way it facilitates lots of different approaches to a high degree of skill. So you can be very, very good at combat. You can be very, very good at stealth. You can be very, very good at using powers in creative ways. And then it spreads that across two different characters who engage with the game completely differently, but who each have lots of freedom to tailor their approach based on specific uses of their different powers and so on. The fact that it pulls all of that off and very rarely fucks anything up makes it, I think, completely remarkable.
Yeah, I think that's definitely one of the reasons I've been replaying it way more than I replayed Dishonored 1, because Dishonored 1 does have some bits that kind of drag or that aren't really sort of... like the Flooded District and a few other bits that are kind of there to serve the story and there to progress you along to the next place, whereas Dishonored 2 feels much more like it's just eight, like, I forget what the word is, but like centerpiece missions. Like each one is just has a really distinct theme and it's gonna check all the boxes that I want from an immersive sim mission, which is it's going to be very open, it's going to have loads of different routes to the objective, it's going to be very free about what you do when you get to the objective. Objectives are usually just to kill or non-lethally dispose of somebody, rather than being pull a switch or go through a door. And so it's also really, really enjoyable to replay. It just feels like you get to pick a playstyle and then try these missions in that new way. And I have started my No Powers playthrough now. What you said about that in Dishonored 1 definitely applies here, where taking powers away from yourself makes you engage with the other systems more and look at the layout of the levels in a much more kind of traditional way. When you have Blink, you're looking at levels like, oh, where would I like to go? I can go there. And when you don't, it's, where can I get to from here? And suddenly you're paying way more attention to the routes and kind of the physical geometry of, like, you know, is that ledge high enough for me to get onto or low enough for me to get onto? And I found myself using stuff like, it actually wasn't this playthrough, it was the one where I was trying to not hurt anybody, and I wanted to steal a rune from in front of like a whole bunch of people who are at, there's like two people at this table, three people at that table, two people at that table, two people patrolling all the way around it, and I've got to get a rune from right in front of like three of them who are sitting at a table just looking at it, and I can't hurt any of them. And so I set fire to a wardrobe on the other side of the room, like with an incendiary bolt, up in a chandelier, and I fired an incendiary bolt into a cabinet, which I think even broke the glass. It made loads of noise, and then it's on fire, so everyone just runs towards it. And as they run towards it, I kind of jumped down behind them, grabbed the room from the table, and just ran out the other door. And that's something I never did when I was letting myself attack other people, and you wouldn't really think to do it, and there's no real reason to. Mm. But as soon, like, the more restrictions you impose on yourself, the more you discover about that game and how rich it is and how many different ways of playing it there are.
It's amazing to me that those levels of spaces are able to contain so many different just simple movement powers and still not be broken.
Yeah.
And still look like human spaces. It's just an amazing conflation of ability design and like art passes to make this amazing world that looks like a real place, and yet kind of supports all these myriad different play styles.
I should point out that even though, I pointed out earlier that it wasn't actually on my top 10, but that's not to say that I can't see why it's on other people's and maybe at the top of other people's. And that's, but it's because I can sort of appreciate those things from that sort of distant perspective or from like secondhand after hearing people's stories. But when I go to play it, like you said, it rewards if you're really good at combat, it rewards if you're really good at stealth. If you are chaotic and not very good at those things, then it can get quite samey, or it can get quite sort of, okay, I've holed up in my safe room, I'm just going to gradually go out, knock people unconscious or kill them and then bring the bodies back. And, you know, you sort of, you turn into this weird spider. I think I called it like a murder squirrel on the RPS, like, entry, calendar entry for it, because I am just sort of at that point not making use of any of the things that you clearly find and that are there for me to explore. I'm just kind of, shit, I've got my safe room, it's got a pile of bodies in it, I'm just going to go out and gradually clear people away from a route. And you can kind of see how that becomes quite repetitive, and the only way that I've found to really engage with it is to play it on console and have somebody next to me, just so that they are laughing along with the ridiculousness of it, because that helps make it a performance or make it like a shared fun thing, rather than being like, oh god, there is a great game in here and I just can't get to it and I'm just doing the same thing over and over. Mm. So it's been really cool hearing like how other people have been doing.
So next up we have Far Cry Primal.
Yes.
It's definitely not what I wrote.
It looks like Primal.
Yeah, to spell. But it is nonetheless a game that almost, I mean, talking about games that were overshadowed this year. Poor old Caveman Far Cry.
Yeah, it didn't seem to sort of resonate with anyone except me, pretty much. And a few of my friends. My friend Zach got really into it. And to me, it was like, you know, I've talked many times in the podcast about how much I love taking down outposts in Far Cry 3 and 4. And this absolutely has that. And the only things I ever used for that was like bows and knives and stones, all of which existed in the prehistoric era. And so all those are there. And then there's also throwing spears, which are just cooler versions of bows. There's a double bow, which is twice as good as a regular bow. And taking those down, they also feel like actually better designed in some ways this time through. They're prettier because they're more primitive, which just inherently makes sense to me. But often they'll be set into a cliff, and you'll have to, if you want to scout it out properly, you've got to go up, like, scramble up the side of the cliff, or take a really long detour to get to that high spot, and then that'll overlook this village, and then scout out every guard that's patrolling, and you still tag them like you do in Far Cry 3 and 4. There is a fucking psychic owl, but I suggest you don't use that, because that spoils the whole tagging thing. You don't have to do it anymore, because you've got a psychic owl. And you can have the psychic owl attack people, which again spoils the... most of the kind of really weird supernatural things it did, you should just ignore. And I also
where
don't
is
even.
This owl? Where is it from?
I think you tame it early on. I can't remember. I think it tells you you're a wizard, and then you have to go to Hogwarts. I actually can't remember how you get the psychic owl, but it's.
Can it like tell me what I'm thinking about?
Sorry?
Can it like tell me what I'm thinking?
Pip, you can tell you what you're thinking.
It's... No, but I mean...
So it's psychic in the sense that it flies up and sees all the guards, and then you know where the guards are. So it kind of...
Oh, so it's a reconnaissance owl.
So maybe you're psychic and the owl is just a normal owl.
Imagine writing a scene...
Very tame, but normal owl.
Imagine writing a scene where the main character obtains a psychic owl.
And that's all he does with it.
And it's forgettable. how do you write a forgettable version of that scene that you don't remember?
The story I did not pay much attention to. I actually played it with subtitles off, and it's all in a made-up language. So if you don't have subtitles, there's literally no way to know what they're saying, which is great. But yeah, so taking down outposts is great and better than ever. It is astonishingly beautiful. I just can't believe how good it looks. And this is not just in my head, I don't think, because I was seeing it and like jaw literally dropping and hammering screenshot all the time. And then I post those screenshots and other people would tell me, holy shit, that game looks amazing. Why didn't anyone tell me this game looks amazing? And the answer is, I don't know. I don't know why that wasn't a point that people made. Like, I feel like I don't know who needed to release it and what they needed to call it, but there's some version of like developer and name that would make people say, holy fuck, this game is the best looking game ever created.
Was it because people got a bit stung by Blood Dragon maybe? Or maybe it was like...
There's definitely some Far Cry fatigue. They've done 3 and 4 are very similar.
The marketing was terrible as well. I remember I got like an email about... I think the only email that sticks in my mind that I got about that game was really terrible, because it was essentially, we made a gamer living room out of stone. And they'd essentially carved a gamepad out of stone. A game console and like a TV. But they hadn't even like done all of the things. Like I think there was... Anyway.
Did you make it all less?
Anyway.
So those are the two great things about it. And the third great thing about it is the that it's just teeming with life. And they've done this a little bit in 3 and 4. There's animals, and the animals get into fights with bandits, and animals get into fights with animals. But it feels like they've taken it to another level of this. Like, there's just so much wildlife everywhere. It's just crawling with wolves and deer and boar and bears and saber-toothed tigers. Oh, my. And I just sat in a valley one time just watching. I think I was watching, like, a couple of tribesmen, and they seemed to be really intent on something, so I watched them, and I realised, oh, they're hunting wolves. And then they got into a fight with the wolves, and I think the wolves killed them, and the wolves started chasing some boar, and then the boar ran off, and the boar startled some deer, and the deer ran somewhere else, and then a bear showed up, and then some more tribesmen were walking past the bear, and then they saw the bear and started to just yell and run, and the bear attacked them, and they fired flaming arrows at it, or like a torch or something, and set fire to the bear. And now there's a flaming bear. The flaming bear is running through the valley, burning down all the trees that it passes. And then some of that is startling other wildlife, which is running out of, in different directions. And it's just amazing to watch. Like, I can just sit there and watch that game unfold without interacting with it in any way and be happy. And then, you know, if you don't want to just watch it, you can then figure out how you sneak up on that group of hunters and take them out, or use the animals to your advantage. I would lure bears halfway across the world to get them to attack a village for me, so that they would like start the fight. There was one where just like a single bear just wandered into a village, and I just watched it take the entire thing out. Not through direct violence necessarily, but through like it would catch fire, the fire would burn down the buildings, people would run out of the buildings, then they'd see the bear, then they'd attack it, then they'd run away from the bear and see another bear, and another bear would attack.
Are bears particularly flammable? This whole thing.
Fire just comes up a lot, like.
You discovered it.
It's because lots of everything uses. Everything else you can set fire to dies when you set fire to it. And bears are incredibly tough, so they can be set fire to and continue to exist and cause trouble. And also, all of that, it happens at night as well, and it's different at night because different types of creatures come out at night. And the night is just again beautiful, but also like very dark. But you can still see what you're doing, but it's just terrifying. Like, you can only just see what's in front of you, and you just hear the howls all around you, and you can tell like the predators are out. And my first night in Far Cry was just one of those. Far Cry Primal was one of the most unforgettable experiences of just being in a proper wilderness, just being terrified of everything around me, sneaking through bushes, just wanting to get through it, and being like captivated by all the horrible things around me, like watching wolves hunt other animals, and hearing noises that I didn't know what they were yet, and just trying to survive.
Sounds great. I really, that really might be one of my Christmas games, actually.
Yeah,
I feel like I completely missed it because
it came out at a very strange time as well. Like, was it January? Like early January? Is that kind of slipped and fallen off the schedule?
I think it was earlier this year, but I don't think it was as early as that.
Maybe in February.
Okay,
a bit further in.
I don't think it was late in February. Might be wrong.
I want to see all of this wildlife, but I think I don't like Far Cry enough to.
Mm.
But I'll probably watch over your shoulder and tell you to take screenshots, maybe.
Mm. And to be nice to the bears.
Well, I mean, you with your sort of, oh, it's a flaming bear, but oh, the psychic owl, how boring.
Like... flaming bears aren't psychic, that's fine. You can set fire to a bear in real life, I'm sure.
But you know, I'm just saying, your priorities are all out of whack.
It's because the flaming bears create interesting emergent mechanics, whereas the psychic owl just ruins the one good mechanic about intelligence in that game.
That's why owls haven't evolved psychic powers in real life.
You're quite right, you should know their place.
Well, one thing that a flaming bear would definitely cause a systemic problem for is the protagonist of Firewatch.
Very good.
Oh, that's a flaming bear riding a Segway there.
Wow.
Through the woodlands of Montana. I didn't play Firewatch, as you can probably tell.
It's Wyoming.
Wyoming.
I think it's in Arizona, actually. Tucson, Arizona.
Wyoming, Montana, they're basically
the same. Tucson is.
No, it might not be.
No. Tucson is, I think, yeah.
I don't know.
Not the Blood and Wine Tucson. No, okay. That's not like one of those weird...
I'm going to go there and look at it.
Don't.
Like that for myself.
I like Firewatch. Brilliant. Great.
Great.
I really love the sense of place, the colour palettes, like the actual look of the game. The story itself was kind of not... like, it wasn't top... I was going to say top drawer. That's a sex thing, isn't it?
Mm.
Top drawer's fine, I think.
What do you mean? Like,
I think top shelf is like where the dirty mags are. Right. Top drawer is just a very good drawer to keep.
Okay, fine.
Keep your jewellery in the top drawer, right?
Yeah, maybe. And your combat.
But you say top shelf top. They're both fine.
Anyway, so.
Top story.
It wasn't a top drawer story, but, like, it was, like, I liked that the protagonist wasn't necessarily someone who made appealing or lovable choices, I think. And I enjoy, it freed me up to roleplay him as a bit of a dick, if you see what I mean. Like, I think in most games I feel a lot of pressure to play as someone nice because I'm conflict averse in real life, or, you know, I don't enjoy conflict as a result of those choices, and sometimes it's quite freeing to be able to do different things within a game space. And him sort of starting the game with a choice that I wouldn't have made or didn't necessarily agree with kind of freed me up to instantly distance ourselves and, like, sort of treat it more as seeing it as an experience through his eyes rather than me being the player in this space.
Did you ever get your pictures developed and sent to you?
I did, and I got a whole different set as well. Awesome. So I got the pictures that I'd taken in game developed, and yeah, that was kind of interesting for various reasons that I went into on a post on RPS that will probably be too long for this. Maybe we could link to it in the show notes,
yeah,
or whatever.
Sure thing.
But I also got my screenshots, like I cropped them and developed them through a photo printer and stuff, and I really like those, actually. Like, there's some really kind of, that feels like maybe more of an accurate representation of my journey through the space, because I could crop them to be what I wanted them to be. And they feel, as a result, sort of more reflective of the mood that I had when I was in the thing, because I curated them slightly more and edited them a bit, whereas the others kind of had that almost, you know, well, I mean, it's something that I remember from having more film cameras and disposable cameras, is that you'd take all of these photos to kind of record the moment, but then it was like, really, that was the moment? Oh my God! Oh, well. But yeah. That was
kind of cool. Do you guys play Fire Watch?
No. Yeah. I found it like a really beautiful walk in the woods. That was my takeaway from it. The story didn't work for... The story didn't work for the same reason it did work for you, in that, that it's, like I say, it's to sort of establish, put the character in an impossible situation, and then didn't really give you any options to be a nice guy about it, really, I felt. And I didn't like him, and so I didn't like being him, really. And so I never fully engaged with the story. Like, I didn't want to flirt with Delilah. And there are no non-flirting options. It's just flirt or ignore her. And if you ignore her, it still was really like, God, like, I should just be telling her I'm not interested, but I don't have that option, so.
There were a few times where you could be snippy with her.
I didn't want to be rude. I just wanted to be up front.
Oh, I was rude.
Just as a place, it was absolutely gorgeous, and I really loved, I particularly loved the sort of shifts in light and colour of that place. Like, you're in the same area, not like different parts of the same map, but you can see the map from pretty early on. You can go to most places of it fairly early on, and often it's just revisiting as places. But you come back and they're transformed just because it's a different time of day and a different weather condition, and more than almost any other game, it makes those things actually have character and actually feel like unique scenes.
Have you been back since they added the, like, free roam mode for it? Because I feel like if you were just not bothered about the narrative, then that would actually be a really cool thing that you might enjoy.
Next on the list, we have Hitman. Hitman.
Yeah, Hitman 2016.
Yeah.
I've taken to sort of just referring to the episodes as, like, you know, Hitman Sapienza or Hitman Hokkaido. I have just now played all of it. I've just caught up with it. For a while, I was getting really behind. And I think I kind of hit a bit of a stumbling block with the Bangkok mission. But now I've played Colorado and Hokkaido, and I think they're both really good. Colorado I wasn't expecting to be good, because people told me it was like, it's the only one where you're not in a safe area from the beginning. Like, everyone there is hostile to someone who looks like Hitman. they look at you and think, hey, that's a Hitman. He's not supposed to be here. Hitman, huh? Looks like you're going to assassinate some of us. Hey, we should shoot you.
Oh, wait, shit.
But that had almost no bearing on my playing in this game, or that mission, because my first run through, I think I finally figured out how to play this game, because it's very much a game that's designed to be replayed. On your first time through, you're never really going to know exactly how to do it. You're going to be stumbling into mistakes all the time. And it's very much a game that's designed to, for you to come back and try different ways. But it also is really judgy, and it really wants you to play Silent Assassin. It wants you to get the Silent Assassin rating, and every time you do something that isn't that, it will kind of flash up red, non-target killed, or things like that, and mark you down at the end of it. And you can, my first run, I think I got minus 80,000 as my score. And yet, I played it completely stealthily. I was like fairly quick, I think. I took advantage of loads of opportunities, did loads of smart stuff, and I leveled up 6 times because I did so many different like opportunities and feats and stunts and all the things it rewards you for. But I got minus 80,000 because I killed a bunch of people basically. And I've decided that's the way to play it. Like, if you on your first playthrough, just don't worry about killing people, don't worry about like fucking it up, just kind of explore it and get through it, and just whoever you need to kill to make this part easier, just kill them. And then after you've done that, you unlock so much stuff that when you play it again, you've now unlocked starting locations, and often those starting locations give you a disguise already. So you just start in the greenhouse with a greenhouse guy's outfit, or...
Greenhouse guy.
Greenhouse guy. I think there is like a greenhouse militia man or something.
Hey, greenhouse guy.
That's a disguise. And so from then on, it doesn't matter that it's a... you know, theoretically a mission that's hostile to you from the start, because it's not, because you're wearing one of their disguises now, so that works. And then, yeah, I just really enjoyed... That is a mission where this hitman, they do have huge open levels, and they're incredibly rich with opportunities and ways to exploit them and things you can do. Loads and loads of, like, weirdly... Again, the main narrative of the story is not particularly interesting, but the way story is woven throughout the levels is great, and there's just so much dialogue in that game. There's so many people talking, and sometimes they're saying dumb, funny things, and sometimes it's kind of intriguing. In theory, on paper, it sounds like kind of Blood Money writ large, and just like 10 times better than one of my favourite games of all time. But it doesn't always work out that way when the missions are super high security, because very often there's 2 targets and each one has like 2 bodyguards who follow them everywhere they go, and the only way you can ever get them away from those bodyguards is to take advantage of one of the opportunities, which are these pre-scripted things of like, if you find this guy's secret cocktail recipe, then you can stand at the bar and make him that cocktail, and then if you'd poison that, then he's poisoned now. And there are a bunch of those, but those still feel like playing into the designer's hands. It still feels like choosing one of the options the designers have given you. I don't find those that satisfying. Whereas Colorado, and to some extent Sapienza, and all my favourite missions in this are ones where you don't have to use the opportunities to get people away from their bodyguards. Colorado has 4 targets, and only one of them is really well guarded. The others just wander off on their own a lot. And it really reminded me of like what I love about Hitman, of just inventing my own solutions. It doesn't even have to be one that no one's ever found before or the designers didn't know I could do. Just the feeling of like figuring out for myself how I do this is so satisfying. There's one where I just noticed there's a challenge for crushing this woman under a car in the garage. And I already knew the car in the garage, where you press a button and it slams down. And there's a guy working on it and he's frequently underneath it. It's very easy to kill him with it. But she never goes under it as far as I can see. But there's a point in her patrol route where she goes a little bit near it. And so you could throw a coin under the car and she would hear the noise and come and investigate, except that guy's there. So he hears the coin and he goes to investigate. So then the next step is like, okay, well, I've got to get rid of that guy. So then I ended up like, him investigating a coin is no good because I don't want to crush him under the thing. I don't want to kill him. And there's loads of people around, so it's not that great to be seen killing him. But if I placed my gun on the ground in his garage, then hid behind a toolbox and then threw my coin at my gun, he would hear the noise, look around, see the gun, and then when he sees the gun, he's like, this gun shouldn't be there, and he walks over and picks it up and takes it to a safe room, at which point he's alone, and I can take him out then, and then I can go back to the garage and throw a coin under the car when she walks past, and now she's the nearest person to it, so she comes to investigate, and she walks under the car, and then I can press the button to crush her. And there's a challenge for that, so the developers know you can do that, and they've thought of it, but I felt like the process of doing that was me figuring out how to do it, and it's probably not the only way, it might not even be the way they were thinking of. But that's the process I enjoy with Hitman. And so this Hitman does have that, but every now and then it's, I think, too high security, and so the ones I enjoy are the ones where you can play around more.
Do you know what I would have done with the lady in the car?
What?
So I would have balanced the car on top of a half-open door, and then when she walked through, she would open the door and it would fall on her.
It's a classic
and she would
prank.
Be squashed.
I think you're envisioning quite a different game.
I think I'm envisioning, like, the Hitman Chuckle Brothers expansion. Like, Rotherham.
Chuckle Brothers with a gravity gun.
The Kerbal Murder Program, where it's all about weird kind of physics object calamities taking people out.
That would be great.
That would be good, yeah, actually. Hitman was sort of almost made onto my list, but didn't quite because I think there were better stealth murder games this year, to a greater extent, well, to be honest. But it definitely was like one of the games I played the most of. Like, I kept coming back to, and I think it deserves quite a lot of credit for at least the experiment of the elusive targets. Like, I don't think it quite worked out.
Yeah.
I think they were actually too frequent. They should have been more substantial and less frequent rather than like one a week or whatever it felt like for a while. But stuff like that was really cool. It felt very different to any other kind of stealth challenge. Like the experience of the first elusive target was great. And like genuinely unlike any other interaction I've ever had with a stealth murder game, and I play a lot of stealth murder games, so that was, you know, something special. Like, just that feeling of like having to wait for the perfect moment because you don't get a second shot. And yeah, people have figured out workarounds and stuff since, but there was something about, you know, and even in the end, and it was really anticlimactic, and I just waited in a cupboard, walked out of the cupboard, killed the guy with the letter opener, and fucked off rather than do it elegantly. But you know, that was my solution, and it worked, and there was a thrill having done it, and then being able to tweet the score screen to say like, I've done it, I've joined the club of people who've done it. And then, you know, subsequent ones is like, got a sniper rifle, went to my high and shot him, because it turns out that's a really good way to kill people.
It's really annoying. We tried to do that one as a team, and then you just sniped him and ran away, and I was like, and I was there.
Was like,
it was sad.
Balance a car on a door. I was thinking gun.
Thinking gun from my sniping spot.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, nonetheless.
Poison the jam, fling the jam onto the toast, you know.
Yeah.
Not happening.
No. Hitman's
also
Hokkaido,
impossible.
Sorry, Hitman's Hokkaido mission is the place that I want to live now. It's a super high-tech hospital, and it doesn't sound that appealing, but you walk around and it's like set in a mountain range in the snow, and it's got like a hot spa, and it's also like a beautiful, incredibly high-tech like hotel and resort, basically, but it happens to be a hospital as well. And it's such a nice hospital. I would like to contract a terrible heart condition and have to go there for a long time.
Is this your like Howard Hughes kind of like end condition? Great. I'm gonna be so. Hang on, we've determined where you three want to live.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder where I want to live. Let's find out.
Devil daggers.
No, that's the worst game to live. Eternal, never-ending spider hell.
Yeah.
No, if you get beautiful high-tech hospital, you get fantasy south of France, and you get under the sea or whatever it was.
Under the sea garden.
Yeah, then I don't have to live in eternal spider hell.
Okay, fine. Where do you want to live?
I think there's some space games on the list.
Are you going to live inside a robot or something?
Well, let me think. No, not inside a robot.
You say that as if it's ridiculous. It's like on your bucket list, I'm sure.
You know, I'll get to it. We'll get to it when I get to it on the list, because I'm not sure what it is yet. Next on the list, though, is Hollow Point.
That's a VR game that, the only VR game that's on my list, that I almost forgot about, because I've just been filing VR games in a different category to video games. and then I realised, oh yeah, that came out this year. And it was amazing. It's a Vive game where you stand, you're in like a virtual dojo, and you have a bow and arrow, and initially they're just cubes that appear around you, and you shoot the cube, and when you shoot it, it fires a bullet at you, and you have to physically dodge that bullet with your body. And there are many cubes at once, and so if you want to play it efficiently, it involves shooting this one, and then while you're dodging the bullet from that one, shooting the other one. And something about dodging and aiming a bow at the same time is incredibly cool. And it's one of those things where it goes as fast as you want it to go, basically. If you don't shoot them at all, it takes them a long time, but eventually they kind of expire and fire the bullet anyway. You know, once you've learned the basics, you'll be shooting them much quicker than that, and you can go as fast as you like. And it's really just a question of, like, how much difficulty do you want? If you want to shoot, like, three of them in a row and then dodge all three of those bullets whilst also aiming at the fourth one, you can do that. And it's the game that really made me realise that VR is just a totally different realm for, like, skill, for the skill ceiling of a game. You have so much more expressiveness and precision in how you interact with these worlds, and it's so much more instinctive. you can just discover you have skills you didn't know you had, or, you know, develop them. And that thing of, like, spinning around on the spot, it's definitely a game where you turn around a lot, which clashes badly with the Vive's cable because you wrap yourself in it. I've learned to manage that now, and I've got better at it, but initially, like, every time I never died, I would just, every run ended with a cable.
I thought you were talking about the cable actually killing me.
We're on third Tom Francis in
of course that killed me. But in the game, I never actually failed the game. I just would always kick the cable out before I got to that point. But now I've got to the point where I can manage the cable better. And when you're not thinking about the cable, it is the kind of game where you can, like, twist around on the spot. And as you're twisting to, like, face a threat behind you, on the way, you notice, like, three other targets. And then when you, like, twist back to shoot at those, because you've already seen them, even in just, like, the split second while you're looking at something else, your subconscious is already, like, programmed into your muscle memory exactly how to hit them all. And you just shoot three arrows one after the other and hit all three, like, in rapid succession. You just feel so fucking cool.
That sounds really fun.
Yeah, sounds great.
Let's play that, actually. You need to get the Vive back. What are you doing?
I need to stretch out my knees because I'm in this small corner. You can move your arms to over the top if you need.
That's okay.
Well, fine.
Next on the list is Olly Olly Oxenfree.
Another beautiful adventure game. Came out a similar time as Firewatch and also involves a radio as your main tool.
It does.
I really like this, and it stuck with me. It's kind of a horror adventure game, I would say. Very
like
creepy.
In that horror that I was listening to a podcast called The Message at around that same time, and it's kind of a sci-fi horror-ish radio play, basically, about like a message that has come from space or that seems to have come from space and also seems to be killing people who listen to it. And so in terms of its general atmosphere, it reminded me a lot of those kinds of stories, but also it revolves around a sort of group of teenagers on an island, and, you know, it was kind of... I really like that those stories are getting a bit more airtime, and it sort of, it felt closer to like young adult fiction. And I really liked seeing that, but also because of the radio side of things, you have to sort of tune in to sort of get some of the story content or to, you know, for some of the puzzles and things like that. It also does, so you get like a lot of this like crackling and whatnot, but in terms of the visuals, sometimes the actual sort of game screen will glitch out. And I really enjoyed that. It's kind of like there was a crunchiness to it and a kind of like out of focusness or sort of that visual noise that just really fit well with what the game was actually doing.
It's funny, in the same way that the West Wing kind of popularized the walk and talk in dramas, this kind of invents the walk and talk for adventure games, in that the conversations happen while you're moving around the world.
Yeah.
And they can also be layered on top of, like, while you're talking to your friend, you can move up to something and interact with it, and your character has something to say about it, and she will interrupt her friend to talk about it, and maybe even ask him about it, and then he'll respond to you, and then when he finishes, you'll get back to the conversation you were just having, all while moving around the world, and things are going on. And that just works so well. It, like, flows so much better than most adventure games.
A few bits of it were a bit wonky in that sometimes you'd click on a thing and it would wait until that other person had finished speaking before it kicked in. And so you'd sort of get used to that, but then you'd try and do that again and it would instantly interrupt them and you were like, oh shit, I wanted to hear what they had to say and now they think I'm rude or, you know, whatever else. But I haven't been back to play the New Game Plus thing though. That's probably on my list of Christmas things to...
How does that work?
I do not know. I am going to find out.
Because usually that's the thing where, like, you start the game fresh, but with all the abilities you unlocked.
I just saw the title of a news article that I think Alice wrote, and it was like, hey, it now has New Game Plus. I was like, great.
When you played it, had anyone else on your friends list played it?
I was playing it for review, so not so much.
Do you know about what it does?
You were telling me about it, like, at dinner the other day, I think. It sounded really cool. But I didn't experience any of that because it was just me.
Only old Pip.
Yeah, solitary.
Speaking of the game that I might live in, I've been enjoying Stellaris. And I appreciate I've spoken about Stellaris on the pod relatively recently. I'm not just saying that because it's space. I'm saying that because it's beautiful. It's a game about, ultimately, really, like, it has its own twists and turns. Being a Paradox Grand Strategy game, the reason I put it on my list is because it's the first Paradox Grand Strategy game that I've really clicked with and that has made me want to kind of unpick that kind of thing and learn its ways. But its biggest strength, because they've released updates and patches to address its weaknesses, which are often the mid and late game, is the opening of that game, which is all about sending off science ships into the void and scanning planets and discovering star systems and encountering, you know, anomalies and sort of hints at prior civilizations and then eventually encountering your first alien civilization. And it, even as a very, you know, removed, sometimes rather mathematical grand strategy game, it has these great moments, these sort of great sci-fi moments of first contact and sort of mysteries out in space and so on. It kind of makes me sort of wistful for, you know, life on a futuristic science barge scanning rocks.
As a human man.
As a boring human man.
I love the influences it draws on. Like, there's loads of kind of Arthur C. Clarke rhymes in there, just in there as a thing you can find, pretty much. And it made me kind of really want a 1X game that's just exploration, basically. Because that's, to me, it's always the most successful part of any given 4X is uncovering the map and finding exciting new things. And maybe that's just a totally different mission goal than that game was going for. But yeah, I just want to do that a bit forever.
I think Stellaris does it really well, though, and it lasts a substantially long time.
They do a great job with it. And it is by far the strongest part of the game that I've played of it so far. The structural kind of empire structuring stuff is always feels like tedious busy work in the background, just to enable me to do more of that stuff. So, I mean, that's what I'd like 4X games.
Although I do like the drama that creates of the, you know, I talked about this in the pub previously, but the struggle to retain your values due to the practical necessities of actually then running a civilization. Like, one thing it simulates pretty well is that transition from, like, optimistic space exploration to the tension of first contact to maybe the positive stuff about integration and you know, becoming part of a galactic civilization or a galactic community. You know, and you start to, like, you know, pass edicts with regards to having, you know, inhabitants of your planets that aren't the same species as you, and you start to gain the benefits of free movement between sort of stellar empires. And it's a really interesting thing. And then you get into, like, the sort of the tensions of, like, Federation politics. And so through this, you can basically, like, map out at least the rough outlines of, like, almost every series of Star Trek.
Right.
Because then by the time you get into the mid-game, you're talking about, like, you know, galactic threats and sort of, you know, and, you know, civilizations that you can't trust because they are warlike or whatever. It's great. But it's got its problems, but...
It's always updating as well. It might be on our list next year, given the kind of way that Paradox treat these games anyway. Like, the expansions do a lot for them and a lot of the updates and patches do a lot for them.
Yeah, I have to admit, I started playing after its first expansion, which came out in November.
Right.
Was it Leviathan?
Cool.
The next game, I'm going to pick one I haven't played, because I'm probably going to sneeze again.
Bless you.
I wish I could edit this, but I can't because of the video.
Yeah.
Is.
You could dive out of shot.
I could dive out of shot. It's Quadrilateral Cowboy, Tom.
Hooray.
Yay. Yeah, that's one where I had to, like, I forgot about it at first, and then I had to sort of remember that although I played a whole lot of it outside of this year, it was still a game that came out in this year. And so I think a lot of, like, I think the real moment that makes Quadrilateral Cowboy special is in quite an early mission, after you learn the basics, there's a thing where you have to, like, turn off laser grids. There's three different places, I think maybe four in the final game, actually, where you need to turn off a laser grid, get through it, maybe, like, disable a camera or something, then take four bolts out of a panel, take the panel out, connect your laptop up to the trunk line thing and steal some data, and in some of them you have to steal a briefcase, and each one requires you to kind of put down your laptop and program in a bunch of commands of, like, turn off the laser for 3 seconds, wait 1.5 seconds, then turn off the other laser, and then wait 4.5 seconds and then turn off the first laser again, because that's when I'll be done with all the stuff inside and I'm going to be coming back out. And it takes you a lot, like, there's a real process of iterating on this and figuring out, tweaking these values until they work, testing them, finding out, oh shit, I haven't left myself a big enough window of time and now I'm trapped in this laser grid room. And you can kind of save all that stuff, all the code that you've written to hack into the security system. You tweak it and you tweak it and then you save it. You can even like save it to batch files and run those separately. And even when you die and get reset all the way back to the start, that data is not lost. So you still have your commands, and that's really what the progress you're making, like actually going through the motions, is very easy. And you keep tweaking this thing, and then eventually you just get it right. And once you don't know it's going to be the perfect run, but when you start, when you start it, but then when you go through the run that ends up being the perfect run, where your code is just good enough now, it just disables the right things at the right time. All the work that you've done has just been writing that. And then when the actual final run, you just press enter, and then you just walk through the level full of these really brutal, difficult security systems, and they all just turn off just as you arrive. You do your objective, and they turn back on just as you leave. And it feels like the building is just kind of working for you, like you're sort of, it's almost like an orchestra or something that you're conducting, and making each piece do exactly what you want to do, exactly when you want it to. Or like the scene in the heist movie where someone's done that. That's so much more satisfying because you had to go through that process of tweaking and perfecting that. And that's so awesome.
Yeah, eventually you can, not spoil too much, but you can tie those commands to your blink, gives you a button to blink. And then, so you go into the middle of this facility and I set up like a portable gun outside that was pointing through a slight slat in a window I'd opened outside, and then I was probably laser grid, and I'd set the coordinates of the aim bot to be pointed precisely at a switch, and there were two switches it had to hit. And when I do like a double blink, it would shoot, move down, shoot the other switch, and that would suddenly just activate two separate laser grids that I didn't just walk through just by blinking and activating it. And it's just a really empowering way of manipulating a game world. And all the more so for the fact you have to fucking type everything in. And you are actually just putting a deck down into the world and then typing into it. And there's a very kind of interesting kind of physical connection with the world, just tactile connection with it for having to do all that stuff that I found to be really part of the pleasure, though it might irritate some people, I think. But
my favourite thing is if you put the deck down like half on the edge of the table and then you interact with it, you'll zoom into it to start typing, but as you're typing in it, it'll tip off the desk and your head goes down with it and you just fall on the floor, so you're lying on the side still typing.
Like in real life.
Yeah.
I said this before when we discussed it on the pod, but there's a bit where you put your screen down, and like sometimes you put like two screens down, and then maybe your keyboard down in front of you, you have to place some of these objects quite precisely. And I was there's a bank heist where these banks are just towers above like an abyss. And so I just like put the monitor down or whatever, just put the deck down, and the deck just went just fell off. just went straight off the edge. Fell into the abyss, and it's just like, fucked it. Just got to press the restart button because there's absolutely nothing else to do. It's the most incompetent heist. The guy's just like, he's supposed to be qualified, he gets there, just
that
frozen.
That literally never happens in like spy fiction. There's that cliche sequence of like usually the sniper who like brings the briefcase up to the gantry in the opera house or whatever and like opens it up, and his briefcase has actually got like a disassembled sniper rifle. He never gets it out and like doesn't know what the fuck to do. Yeah. It screws it on wrong,
just drops
and like, drops a really vital part.
Fuck. Or even just forgets the code for opening the briefcase or something. It's like,
shit.
It's great. I should also mention that like Brendan Chung's art and kind of artistic sensibilities are fucking awesome, and he makes these beautiful worlds in a Quake 3 engine or some sort of modified version of it at this stage, where everyone has big boxy heads and everything is quite low poly, but just full of detail and jokes. And I just love the vibe of Blender
Games.
It might
be Doom 3 if you got right. Oh,
really? I think so. It felt a bit different, but the same kind of aesthetic. Love it.
Rad. That might be a Christmas game as well, actually. It's another one I meant to play but didn't get around to. Tom, you and I spent a lot of time playing Total War Warhammer.
We have, yeah. And I think I didn't vote for it in like when we did our PC Gamer picks of the year.
No, neither did I.
But it is my personal pick of the year, like in the kind of separate kind of staff bits that we do. And I think it's because as a strategy game, whatever, it doesn't feel as though it really massively evolves or streamlines the Total War formula. But as a kind of a way to engage with the fantasy of Warhammer, I think it's really successful and really quite accessible. And I love dipping back into it. Doing like a 2-hour campaign, it really allows you to spend 2 hours playing Total War and not having to spend like Empire a whole week, just kind of going through it all.
Yeah.
It gives you the freedom just to enjoy, just very streamlined Dwarves versus Orcs campaign, and it's got to get out again. And it's been a really regular staple of my gaming this year, actually. It's just kind of fallen into a very comfortable pattern, just enjoying it.
It's funny, it surprised me when I looked at my Steam stats just to see how much time I invested in different games that were new this year, and Total War Warhammer beat most things, like just in terms of hours invested. And that's partly because I did play one of a very long form campaign.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I didn't put it on my list either initially, and that was because I think it doesn't do a huge amount that's new relative to other Total Wars. And maybe that's, you know, that's the downside, is that despite having a very fantastical setting, it doesn't necessarily feel that different, even when you're talking about goblins and orcs and magic and, you know, skeletons and vampires and stuff. But it's a very successful rendition of that particular part of that setting.
Mm.
And also, there is still that. And also, I think because it is detached from history, it opens up sort of, I don't know, it felt like sort of okay to, I felt more at liberty to sort of experiment and try mad things and sort of, you know, being, it felt more encouraged to approach battles in a different way than I ever did with Rome. Because my favourite Total War games are the Rome pair, basically.
Yeah.
But in them, you know, they feel more like, obviously they're not simulations, but you feel, you know, they're attempting to recreate something of history, whereas this is trying to recreate something of another game setting, which allows it, gives it a little bit more freedom to solve some of those long-standing Total War issues, I think.
It allows the armies to be super specialised. Mm. So you can have an undead army that just doesn't have any shooting, which you're never really going to, like, oh, historical armies have some sort of range option, even if it's not just slings or something. Whereas for Warhammer, they can focus down on what the army does and severely handicap it in a different way and give it, make you work around those limitations. And also just the units themselves, I think of just, it's more apparent what they can do. So even something like Shogun 2, which is one of the most successful Total Wars, it's still got a lot of different types of subtly different samurai that look kind of the same, and you have to look at their stat sheets to really know what they're good at. Whereas the Total War Warhammer, you know that the giant knights riding griffins are probably quite good at charging into guys, and you know that the tiny little snotlings, they're just these like 1.5 foot tall goblins, probably not going to last very long in combat. Just as a very, just a much better communicated visually what these things can do.
Yeah, Steam tank kind of tells you everything you need to know about what
exactly,
that's going to
do. And it's great. I think they've done a splendid job of modelling those units and going back to the source material and really just doing that fan service element. They've absolutely nailed it in that respect, I think.
Yeah, need to do it for Age of Sigmar now.
I'd love to see that.
Me too.
Yeah.
I'd lose you both forever. Yeah. Never see you again.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Just be me and Tom doing a podcast, hanging out and talking about, like, opposites.
Oh, God. That's the opposite of what I want.
That's not the correct use of opposites at all. I don't know what you're talking about.
Next on the list is Thumper.
Woo.
Well, to give it his full name, Thumper. Woo.
I feel like that's in the same position as Devil Daggers in a lot of ways. Mm. Like, it's in a niche and it is so amazing at the things that that niche requires. Like, it's you know, a perfect rhythm action game.
It's the best game this year of being an iron beetle riding an acid guitar string into hell.
Yeah, exactly. And so it kind of, it conveys all of that. It's got the right sort of crunchiness. It's it feels frantic, even though you can kind of control the thing when you get to grips with it. I think the only gripe that I had with it was that I don't agree with what you said before, that it introduces the abilities particularly well. I feel like it could do more in terms of tutorial.
It never really explains anything. It's just kind of like,
no, but like, I essentially, something that you had done just by, like, when you saw the thing and you were doing the interaction, it was the right form of the interaction. Whereas I was doing something that was like, it would yield the correct result, but it would be slightly wrong in terms of the input. Like, I can't quite remember what it was.
Was it like holding down where you just need to tap?
I think I was holding something down. Like, I was holding down an arrow key, maybe, and a space bar, and then letting go when I thought the crucial moment was. And sometimes that worked, and sometimes it didn't. And it was because if I'd just sort of tapped it, it would have worked all of the time. But, yeah, and so I thought that because that had happened, you know, like it was more a matter of whether you start off making the correct assumption and then it reinforces that, whereas, you know, you can just end up thinking, oh shit, I'm just not doing it right, and like failing again and again.
But it's a game about failing again and again for some extent, right? Like you...
But you fail if you fuck up the rhythm. You don't fail because it hasn't imparted the correct input that you put in at that point.
I think there is some degree of trial and error with that stuff, generally.
But if it gives you the right result most of the time, but you're not understanding why it's going wrong the rest of the time,
I think,
and you just sort of get hung up on the idea that maybe you're just not timing it to a nanosecond correctly, when actually it's just a case that you hit the button and then it's fine all the time.
I mean, I think, in that specific case, one of the things I quite like about Thumper as a rhythm action game is that it actually allows for, like, you to do, you can get through doing most of what you need to do, but in order to get through in the best way, there's actually quite a lot more you can be doing at any given point. So there is, I think there is some degree of, like, wiggle room when it comes to, like, letting you survive off certain mistakes but not others. But I understand that when you're talking about maybe having misinterpreted how a controller is supposed to be used, then it's not quite the same thing.
Like, when you're getting a basic input wrong, and when it works maybe 75% of the time, but two wrong things and you are dead and have to restart, like, that's the point where I would disagree it's taught you well. But everything else was on point. Like, it felt amazing to play once all of that was sorted out. Like, the actual visuals were just so cool. It's like this organic metal. There's like a really cool beetle. Like, it's really cool that you know that you've sort of, you're one mistake away from death because its wings get ripped off. Yeah. But then sometimes they come back, like, flapping back in, you know, like zoom back onto your chrome body.
No,
so
amazing.
Cool.
Looks amazing. I think I was lucky to play it on controller, like on a pad. Which seemed to, maybe that helps if, like, spacebar is quite a big key to get kind of inputs for sometimes. Maybe if it's a bit of a less precise tool. I think what I really enjoyed about it was that it kind of builds a lot of variety and kind of options into two-dimensional setup, right? But the idea that you can bounce off stuff, elevate, hit extra points, slam down to get points that then unlock other points. But there's so much kind of... those are hidden mechanics that you get just by doing stuff. And that encourages you to replay and actually do the score attack thing. And kind of unlock all this kind of hidden potential in the route. And the idea that it has all that complexity and just such a narrow line with such focus is really, really, really cool design.
And how it can, like, vary the experience, the feel, the difficulty, like, without seeming to have changed much.
It's because it changes the music. Because when you come down, it, like, it changes the stress of the beats and creates extra tension and noise where there wasn't previously if you're doing that.
But also, like, the configuration of the different elements around the track and the fact that sometimes it takes you into these pipes where you can't see as far ahead, or, like, you know, all of that kind of stuff. It just makes it suddenly, like, oh, a lot more frantic or a lot more kind of... Oh.
It's really, really cool. I wish there had been a bit more kind of visual variety to it. I think across the whole, like, the colour palette is pretty much the same and it feels... the same vibe. I mean, it's going for one thing. It's like Death Flag. It's going for the one thing.
Yeah.
And it nails it. But I was kind of done with it by about stage 7, I think, in terms of what it was presenting me. But I think it's a unique game and really fucking cool. I like it.
It's nice.
Yeah.
It's not nice, really. It's like hell.
It's horrifying, but I like it.
It tense my tummy a lot when I'm playing. It's like a core workout. But every time there's a beat.
Think of that poor beetle. Imagine that core week. Cool work out he's getting.
Pinky. Yeah, it's got really hench, like, with the wings, you know?
Above the fact that they come off.
Well, you know, but it's got to... they just slide back in.
Like, real arms.
Well, I mean, just, like, I don't know if he's got, like, a lot of shoulder. Maybe it's easier for that to happen. This is going to get onto weird territory.
We're on to...
I thought you wanted to speedrun this.
Yeah, sure, we're on...
Don't question me. Okay. It will go nowhere fast.
We're on Animal Minutiae, so let's move on to Doom.
Hey!
Again, almost overshadowed now.
Yeah.
Because it was almost the best shooter of the year. But it's not. But the but it's great. Surprisingly great. Like, I think everyone sort of didn't know what to expect from Doom. Even though, like, Wolfenstein New Order was so good, no one knew what to expect from that either.
So they're different studios. So if it had been...
They are different studios, but under the same publisher. So,
yeah.
I mean, you can argue that some of the sensibility might cross. And maybe it's fair to worry about Doom simply because by all accounts, its development was relatively fraught and it haven't really shone. Like, Rage was okay, but it wasn't amazing. Tried to do too much. And the great, you know, hallmark of Doom, and by all accounts, I think that maybe changed about it halfway through development, is that it doesn't try to do too much. It's like, it doesn't try and really... It successfully modernizes Doom, which is the oldest FPS concept, pretty much, by not trying to modernize it in the way that everyone has previously tried to modernize stuff like that. So it doesn't try and do scripted sequences and, you know, puzzles and, you know, you don't spend very much time reading email logs and wondering what really happened on Mars. You spend a lot of time kicking things in the face until bits of them come off.
Yeah.
And there's so much that's, you know, very sort of throwback about it. In every level is a maze. Every, you know, you're talking about finding red key cards to open red doors. You can carry all the weapons you want. You are just a sort of walking arsenal that moves super quickly. It recaptures that element of the original game where you are running at 20 miles an hour everywhere you go and nothing really makes any sense. And it's as much about the soundtrack, and enemies are just sort of punctuation on this sort of... It's almost a rhythm action game, actually. Like, this sort of, like, you know, little rampage you go on in every level until it's kind of cracked. But in addition to that, they've solved little problems with Doom and with shooters generally. So, you know, rather than opt for a, you know, like a regenning health system or something like that, which encourages you to take cover, or to encourage you to run away from the battle to find health pickups before returning to it, you are encouraged to do the melee takedowns on stunned enemies in order to basically like crack them open for health. Yeah. And that's a really clever idea because it means that the correct direction to be moving in is always like forward, whereas normally in an FPS the correct direction to be moving in is sideways. Like the circle straight for it, which is the sort of the most overpowered thing that no one has ever really done. And I love that little basic sort of root level recalibration of what, how you approach a shooter arena. Like sometimes you do need to be charging past a wall so that the hell demon attacking you from one side doesn't get you. But most of the time it's a sort of like a triumphant charge through an arena, chaining together kills in the right way to crack it. And maybe you have to replay that if you die, but maybe not. Rather than either a stop-start progress through it or some sort of like, you know, meticulously planned like pickup strategy or anything like that, with sort of like knowing where to go in the arena to get the health or the armor at the right time. And it's just, you know, brilliant 10 hours of basically that. And it's
fantastic. I was so convinced that the close combat takedowns were a kind of marketing gimmick that they could put in trailers, but actually when you go to play it, it's absolutely integral to the way that that game works. And that combined with the way movement feels, like you're the gliding across the world, and double jumping feels amazing in that game, just moving around feels incredible. The guns look and sound amazing. It's just they absolutely focus on a few core kind of things and absolutely nail them, the kind of game feel of them.
Phenomenal sound too, yeah, like phenomenal sound, music as well. Like they really nailed the soundtrack. Multiplayer's rubbish,
yeah,
which is a weird thing to have fucked up, given that they got single player so right.
It's like a totally different game in multiplayer. It's really strange, like a different studio has done it, which I don't think is the case. But you know,
like the multiplayer game is it's a game of unlocks and damage numbers coming off people in Doom, which should be the... Like, this is a game that originally in its first incarnation famously kind of didn't fully do away with the health bar because it had health. But, like, its most, you know, its prime visual representation of how well you were doing was the angry, bloody man's face. Like, you know what I mean? It's never a game that ever really wants to represent anything through something as boring as a number. It wants to show you everything. It's and, you know, it never wants to be anything less than kind of, like, you know, in your face about that kind of thing. And so the multiplayer, which was a bit sort of finickety, like, it was okay. Like, I had some fun with it.
Yeah, it was all right. It was interesting because there are games like Reflex and the new kind of community Unreal Tournament that Epic are working on, the commercial community, that are trying to do the stuff that the Doom multiplayer should have been, because those movement systems already feel incredible. They've got all that down. Then just turning that into just a point blank frag fest would have been just a joy, I think. A 10 minutes of fun every now and then. But instead it became quite a technical kind of unlock heavy, almost
power boosters and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. So it was just a bit bloated, a bit weird. But the single player is fantastic, love it.
And that brings us on to the actual best shooter of the year, which is Titanfall 2.
Yeah.
Which is also, for what it's worth, the last game on this list.
Well, finishing on high.
Yeah.
Do XCOM?
Shit, I forgot about XCOM 2. It's not the last game on this. Do you know why that is? It's exactly the thing I said it would happen.
That's the X by the XCOM, yeah.
What about the top of
I'm
the...
I'm skipping some of mine. Unless you want to go back to them.
Well, I thought... Okay, never mind.
For the sake of time, I'm skipping some of mine, but I can, if there's anything you would like to go off the list.
We could just mention, like... We should probably mention No Man's Sky.
Sure, let's do No Man's Sky now then.
Okay.
Because it's one of the games that I've probably spent the most amount of time in, but that hasn't been commensurate with enjoyment nor with expectation, I don't think. But I don't want to write that off because of those other things.
I originally had it on my list, and yeah, so sorry for saying I was going to skip it. It was just because it was only on my list. And the reason for that is I... a perfectly lovely time with it because I bought it. This is in the case of getting it for free and not being disappointed. Fully accept that it didn't live up to its marketing materials. I think the response to it, while I understand individual disappointment in expressing that, the kind of the situation it's ended in with that community is nothing less than fucking embarrassing.
Just disproportionate,
for this hobby. Like it's a whole like pack it up and go home kind of deal. Like why the hell would you harass working human beings like that and on that scale? It's madness. But I had a perfectly lovely time with it, and while the distinction between expectation and reality is kind of hilarious in some cases, all I really wanted was a sort of a quiet jaunt through some brightly coloured planets, and for the 10-12 hours or so that I did that, I had a perfectly nice time.
Yeah,
I think I had similar, and I didn't exactly have expectations, if you say. I mean, especially given that I'd had a hands-on preview of the game, but like, yeah, again, I sort of would look at the marketing material and be a bit that's not the game as it came out, but I also really appreciate the work that they're putting in trying to sort of find what the game is, if you see what I mean. But I think we've had this conversation before. I feel like they had a feeling they wanted to impart through the game, and then it was about trying to find the clothes to dress it up in to provide that for people. And so now it's more about sort of responding to community feedback in providing different tools so people can have different experiences. And I think behind Subnautica, it is like my second most screenshotted game of the year, and I've had some absolutely lovely kind of times with it. I mean, I've uploaded so many videos of just me laughing at ridiculous animals that I've found, and they've been truly delightful, and I've really enjoyed that. But like, it's one of those things where it also gets a bit samey, or it gets a bit, it shows you its limitations sooner than you'd think, I think. But also not soon enough that you'd be able to get a refund if that wasn't what you were in for. No, but you know what I mean. Yeah, like, I don't want to, like, kick that kettle of bees. Is that not a phrase?
No.
It should be. Yeah, it's great.
Okay. Don't do it. Certainly don't do that.
Anyway, so I don't want to kick that thing.
We'll kick that kettle of bees when we come to it.
Well, yes. So I don't want to like reopen that debate in a kind of shitty way. But it is more kind of, I think that it would take more than 2 hours to sort of realise where the experience kind of stops providing you with new things. But I think that that point isn't necessarily where you'd want it to be, or certainly it wasn't when the game was released.
Yeah, I think it does have some like serious problems with its like technology progression system and with its inventory system.
Oh, gosh.
And just with the basic way you move on in that world. Maybe to try and stave off that point where you start realising that the procedural generation isn't going to create necessarily the amount of variety that you'd hope. But nonetheless, like, that's what stopped me playing it. I stopped playing because of those systems, not because of what the planets were offering me. So that was sort of great frustration. The fact they've added a survival mode, is interesting.
And a creative mode.
A creative mode. I need to try that then. Maybe that's what I want from it. It's just
unlimited building costs and
That's it. I mean, I just want to go strike out and find things. And if the planet's boring, I'll dump it and go to that moon instead. And that's the fantasy of that game for me.
Yeah.
That's what's really exciting about it. But on release, it wasn't. Wasn't quite that.
I've never found any liquids.
Really?
No seas or pools of any kind. Every planet I've ever found has been completely dry.
I tell you something, that's one of the things that does keep sort of reminding me of one of the game's limitations is whenever I find water and there's no sort of sense of erosion or a beach or sort of natural sort of flow from one type of terrain to the other. And like, it can still be magical and lovely or interesting, but it is one of those peculiar things where I'm always like,
In that case, maybe I've just been finding very clear seas. Just been assuming the planet's dry.
Maybe. But I really do appreciate that the new things that they seem to be adding are sort of maybe filling in some of those gaps or responding to some of those
gaps. Giving different players different modes to tap into, maybe.
Like, I didn't really gel with the base building, but then again, I kind of haven't really needed to when I went back. I was just still pootling around, still videoing terrible, weird animals.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was, I just needed a break from that, I think.
There's stuff like I really enjoyed flying space stations and meeting aliens, which is one of the most underdeveloped aspects of the whole game, because it's exactly the same every time you do it. But the first time
you do that, sitting in the same posture, chairs, and they've all got the same dialogue options and the same. Oh my goodness.
But the idea that those space stations have doors that I've yet to unlock, I found really exciting, and I was able to go to some but not others. And there's this a kernel of something really, really exciting about that. If there was like those variety in that aspect of it as well as everything else, it could start to feel like a universe. But it feels like maybe I'll play it in 5 years' time. It's a different game.
I accidentally reactivated the Atlas quest line, and now I'm really annoyed because it's like there's a fucking marker on everything that I do. Because it's like, go over here, and I'm like, oh, I didn't mean to. I don't want to.
Scan a rock. No. Or look at this weird camera.
That's
the No Man's Sky experience.
So let's move on to XCOM 2, because the reason I missed it is exactly what I said would happen when we were planning this. When we wrote down all the games, and then I put a little X next to anything. I put a little X next to anything that was on Graham or Marsh's lists that we had nothing to say about. Games like Samaros 3 or American Truck Simulator. However, it turns out that putting a little X in front of game names and training yourself to ignore that causes problems for XCOM 2. So what I did,
you don't want to talk about this game, COM 2.
Yeah. So what I did was put a tick in front of it. So now it's tick XCOM 2. which confused me even further. But anyway, XCOM 2 is also legitimately one of the best games of the year.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, it's one of those that feels like it lives in distant memory. Cause in March or something like that.
Distant March. How innocent we were.
Yeah. There's many things changed since then. But not my inability to play that game, which remains constant.
Surely you must be good at XCOM.
I'm alright at it, but it kicks my ass so frequently, even though I should know better. And it's one of the things I really enjoy particularly about XCOM 2, because it really feels like a survival challenge. And the way that the kind of the strategy systems force you into... You're always under-resourced, you're always scrabbling for stuff, you're always, you know, making these constantly difficult decisions all the time and losing people and dealing all that stuff, always feeling like you're on the back rope. And then getting those turnaround moments where your awesome sniper suddenly just wipes out at one of the biggest threats on the board and it levels up. And it's just, there are so many highs and lows created by this strategy game. It's stuff I've never experienced in a strategy game before, really, the level of kind of emotional investment.
Yeah, I got so invested in my people, like the squad I made for XCOM 2 are some of my favourite video game people ever. Even though they have no dialogue and do they have dialogue?
No, they just look at each other significantly.
They say stuff when you order them.
It's
around,
dead like, dialogue, yeah. Yeah, they've got barks, yeah.
But just, you know, you get to design their appearance to some extent. I'd usually like whatever it gave me, I would maybe tweak it a little bit, kind of go with the direction it was going in, but you know, change it to my preference a little bit. And then as they level up, you give them class and you give them abilities, and those abilities just get cooler and cooler and cooler. And because they're like, each time you get a choice, so it's always your choice, it's always something you decided was good, and also it's getting better and better and better. And a top level soldier in that game is just so fucking badass. Mm. And if you've also made them look badass and they have a history, like, you know, all the missions they've been through, how they earned all those ranks, like what they did to get that. And a sniper called, who's, I think I gave her this nickname after this mission, but I ended up calling her Killzone, who like wore aviator shades and just looked like a really kind of serious, no nonsense, like proper soldier. Whereas a lot of the other team were a bit more wild and wacky. And she was always the best sniper. She was the highest level sniper. So she always had the coolest abilities. And Killzone is an ability where you just tell them, it's kind of like Overwatch, but it's for a whole range. And you just say, like, in this like 30 degrees or whatever, anything you see, not anything, everything you see, you will shoot. And she was on the roof of like a building opposite a garage. And it was like the first time I encountered, I can't remember what enemy type, but one especially horrible enemy type. I think the ones that are in like exosuits and they kind of spill out and turn into an alien afterwards.
Oh, mutants? No, not mutants.
Whatever. But in the sort of round when the enemies were revealed, I just fucked up and exposed somebody. So she'd run out. I thought she was going to run out. And in fact, yeah, it was the exosuit thing. And one of my best assault people ran out. And I knew for sure she could shotgun it and take it out in this one turn. Shotgun up to ground in one turn, and another fucking alien came out of it. It turns out I have a second life phase, and now I'm just like, fuck, she has no moving points, no one has anything. All I've got is I set up this kill zone. And then in the next turn, like, a whole mob of other enemies that also aggroed and ran into the area, and this alien that also came out in the from the exosuit was trying to attack my soldier. And Killzone just shot and killed every single one of them in one hit. Just every single thing that appeared was immediately murdered. Oh, and it's just, oh my god, I love you.
Yeah, there's so many great, like... So I think... Actually, no, I'm not going to do that thing we've been doing all part of, like, well, this game also did the better. Like, there are things about... But there are things about XCOM Enemy Within that I think, on balance, which is the expansion, sort of the final form of the first of the XCOM reboots, that I think do stuff better, like... I don't chance to talk about it at the time. I do think the final act of XCOM 2 is a bit of a letdown after how good it is at the start, because it has such a great setup and you're trying to rescue the Earth from an alien government rather than, repel an invasion.
Yeah.
But they end up in very similar places, not geographically, but in terms of like what the scenario is.
Yeah.
And I think XCOM 1's conclusion is just way stronger, like across the board in terms of what happens and the fact that like, you know, because XCOM 2 is kind of like a retcon, because it's based on the idea that you didn't win XCOM 1, so therefore the aliens won.
Yeah.
They end up returning to a lot of the same plot beats at the end of XCOM 2 and have sort of failed to move things forward, but also has fewer kind of like planned set pieces for your characters to kind of engage in and for particular ones to become special.
Yeah.
I think because they were worried about repeating the one of your squad members at random is going to be a super powerful psychic plot beat from the first game, but it was such a cool thing.
Mm.
But that thing of having... But the way the powers are designed and the way that things can escalate a lot higher in terms of the power level of your own soldiers creates, like you say, independently super cool moments. I still think, you know, and again, it's not exactly immune to the problem that XCOM traditionally has, where once you get a certain level of power, it becomes a shitload easier. The reverse difficulty curve is definitely still a thing.
Yeah.
But I think the way that sort of resolves itself is way more interesting, because it's not just... We have more health. We've got like, cause in XCOM 1, like one of the big milestones to hit on the road to the game getting easier rather than harder as you played more of it was as soon as you get like a first armor upgrade and suddenly the chrysalids aren't killing you in one hit. And a lot is dependent on armor. And actually in XCOM 2, I think they've been a lot cleverer and there's a lot more that's based on like, well, I have access to this ability that it functionally mitigates damage, but it does it in a completely different way. Now I'm going invisible or grappling onto rooftops or whatever it is and kind of repositioning much faster than I used to be able to.
Hmm.
It becomes sort of steadily more responsive. And yeah, I had the one sniper kills everything moment with Pip, who was the sniper in my game ending. And in the final mission of XCOM 2, there was one sort of like, you know, the flying Egyptian men and whatever else in a huge room, and that kill one thing can keep killing things. Thing triggered to such an extent that plus one instant reload mod to allow it to keep emptying the clip. I think Pip, sniper, I can't remember what your nickname was, killed 9 things in one turn. Wow. Sort of like endless bullet time spiral. It's great.
Yeah, I've had some really good turns in other people's games. Like, yeah. I haven't played it myself, but Alice sent me a gif of, like, I think in her game I had white hair because I'd turned psychic or something. Yeah. And she sent me a gif of me in her game just blowing up an enemy with my mind or something crazy like that. And I was just like, yeah.
Job done.
I do not need to play this game. I'm just good at it.
In the show notes, I will put a link to the Amade Crate and Crowbar XCOM squad file that has everybody in it.
Oh, sweet.
With nicknames and bios.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And all the bios, I believe, are quotes from the podcast.
That's great.
And I think custom nicknames as well. I think your custom nickname is 6 out of 10.
What's Tom's?
I think it's Gunpoint. That felt like the most appropriate.
Isn't that Tom? Oh, come on!
No, it is. Oh, come on! It is. Oh, come on! I couldn't remember if that was the quote or the nickname, but no, that is, the call sign is "Oh, come on!"
We should get to install voice packs for XCOM.
Yeah, we could probably do a Steam Workshop mod.
Maybe so.
That'd be such a fun thing to
do.
Hilarious,
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. All of yours would be "Oh, come on!"
Yeah, reload. Oh, come on!
Yeah, exactly. my call sign was Wizard, but that, I couldn't think of anything else. It's kind of weird to write a joke about yourself.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah, I think I might have to change yours to opposites.
I think that's reasonable. I think you might be a parrot, by the way. I've been thinking about this the whole time.
Just so you know.
It's because I was remembering that gif of that parrot who's having a lovely time, but he's also, like, I think trying to make the cameraman's head.
That's not a
lovely time.
Is it Stephen Fry's head? Yeah. No, it's Stephen Fry's cameraman's head.
Yeah, but...
Isn't that a kookaburra?
I think it's a parrot. It's maybe a grey parrot.
It's a big fat green parrot.
Yeah, but it's a parrot then.
Well, it looks a bit like a parrot.
You've damned yourself by saying it's a parrot.
Fine.
But I remember I sent you that because it was essentially exactly the emotion that you have after pulling off some annoyingly good feat in a multiplayer game and want everybody to know about it.
I just did that on camera.
Yeah, exactly. So there you go.
So are you saying that when I'm successful in a multiplayer game, I look like a parrot that is mounting a cameraman's head?
Yeah, essentially.
I'm glad we're all going to this point as a group.
Well, you know, I didn't want you to feel left out, but I now get the feeling that you would have preferred to be a woodland creature.
There was definitely... No, I mean, like, I can go a parrot.
Roll parrot.
They're kind of sassy. I like parrots.
Oh, God.
They're the most fabulous, but also most awkward birds.
They live a while as well.
Yeah, good old while.
I look forward to XCOM 2 expansion. There is one.
Fucking a beautiful save, Tom.
Yeah.
Dragging it back. Not even a segue, just going to say XCOM 2.
Have there been any mentioned?
No.
They've done some really big DLC packs.
They have. They've also got like a load of big modders on Enemy Within involved to create kind of extra modes and units and stuff, which I've yet to experiment with, actually. But apparently the biggest one they did was they added basically a load of boss monsters. And given how hard some of the enemies are already in that game, like that, you've got to be seriously good to be.
Oh, wow.
I was watching Christopher Rod is a big XCOM player, and I think he's kind of an expert. He plays on, like, Impossible or whatever.
Oh, wow.
And he's also playing with a whole load of mods. And one of them, I'm pretty sure this is a mod, he's in, like, one of those missions where there's loads of chrysalids attacking all the civilians and stuff, and you've got to save them all. And in this mod, there's just, like, super chrysalids that are, like, 8 times the size of regular chrysalids with, like, 4 times the health. And he's just like, you know, regular chrysalids are fine, but then, like, oh, 2 of those things show up.
What a great game.
Yeah, super.
Yeah, I'd love to replay it, actually, I think. But I think I'll wait till the inevitable.
Yeah, I need a good... I have a good excuse, because they finally added normal controller support.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it always has Steam controller support, but now it's got regular controller support, which is what I want.
Mm. Cool. So, finally, Titanfall 2.
Yeah. I love it so much.
It's great. How have you played it yet?
Yeah, I played single player all the way through.
Cool.
And then I played one multiplayer match and thought, multiplayer is not for me. Just in general.
What a surprise that game is and was. Like,
yeah, the multiplayer wasn't surprising to me. The single player was a massive surprise.
Mm. Like, multi-purpose, like, I was surprised by how different it was to the first game.
Mm.
But I love it. Like, it's great. Like, the sense of speed, the lethality of the weapons, the skill ceiling.
My favourite first-person movement in any game
that
I've ever played, Titanfall 2, the way it registers whether you want to wall run, whether you want to mantle through that window, you know, whether you want to go up to that place or just pause on it. Like, the way the system's kind of intuit what you want to do at any given moment is just as good as I've ever... occasionally fucks up, but it's as good as I've ever...
It's like, if you were designing a control system for any kind of game that has any kind of ambiguity in what the player's intent might be, Titanfall 2 is a demonstration that the correct answer is always do whatever the most awesome thing the player could be hoping to do is in this given scenario. So if you aim a grappling hook at the floor in front of you a few metres away, of course you want to pole vault over it and use it to fling yourself into the air. Even though that makes no physical sense, it is kind of, like, it is more interesting than just sort of dragging them to a halt 20 feet forward, right? Like, it's everything about it is so kind of, it's lovely.
Delicious.
I really love weapon whose name I can't remember, but it's the one you get from the robot enemies and when you're on foot. And it's like a rapid fire kind of plasma-ish weapon.
The red plasma.
Yeah, and when it kills people, they just kind of turn into a mist of blood. Like, it just shreds them. And I feel like that is, even more than Doom's plasma gun, that is the true successor to Doom 1's plasma gun. Like, a kind of torrent of energy that just rips people up in a horrible way.
We were all waiting. So that's movement. And the weapons are great. Because there are a lot of, like, SMGs and stuff and, you know, basically shotguns. But even the shotguns are, like, really interesting. Like, the shotgun pistol, which falls over in Tom's kitchen, apparently.
That was unnerving.
Or, like,
should I peer through?
I think it's probably the lid of your delicious cinnamon buns, maybe.
The lid of the bun tin has collapsed.
The buns are escaping.
Which is a good sign that we need to speed this podcast up. We've run out of tape. Because that is genuinely a concern now.
We're just at the 3 hour mark now, so we've got half an hour into possibly absolute maximum.
Presume we read it right. So, the shotgun pistol, the projectiles are going to slight lag, so you can sort of aim it in front of people and annihilate them. To like the one of the breacher shotguns that like opens horizontally when you fire it and does this sort of like cone pellet thing. Like every gun has its own sort of really nice feel to it. Like, I love the alternator, which is one of the simplest SMGs. It's sort of just a close range SMG, but it has this kind of great like controllable punch that is designed to work really well with, I think, moving really quickly. So it's the slide into the gun, fire it at someone's chest and sort of let the recoil carry it up into their head kind of weapon. It's great. And that's not to say anything about the quality of the level design in single player, which is absolutely amazing. Like, even when it's just being a shooter, it's great because it's just fun to slide around and wall run up cool sci-fi things and shoot men, and then it spins that out into great set pieces, whether that's a big Titan battle or an actually cool platforming section or whatever else, or, you know, the big stuff that I still actually don't want to spoil for people because it's been on sale a lot since it came out because presumably it didn't sell very well, which is such a huge shame. And if you encounter it over Christmas instead, then you still deserve to see the midsection of that game for yourself.
Yeah, even the sewer level I liked, and I hate sewer levels and consider them to be like pretty much the laziest kind of setting you can ever pick for a game. But there's the kind of finale of that is such an interesting like dual platform zone where enemies constantly spawn. But you're such a superhero in that game in terms of the way you can slide. As you're sliding, just kind of switch from left to right and shoot headshot people and then just vault up to a different place while your robot is watching you and just kind of admiring how good you are. Even that moment is just a fantastic little design for a shooter.
It's sort of absurd how rad you are given the plot of that game at the start. It's like, I don't know if I'm good enough to be a pilot.
It's like, wait,
now. I'm just a rifleman. Wait, a robot approves of me. Fuck it.
I'm in.
That's all I needed.
I love it. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Titans are really good as well. There are Titans in it. You can stop around a robot.
Yeah, they've done a good job of expanding from the original...
Three.
Three to... how much is it? Five?
Eight.
Oh my God.
Hang on. I did a box out. It's definitely more than five.
Yeah.
Probably six.
Okay.
I can't remember exactly.
But they're all interesting, and they all feel more spectacular and more like kind of Power Rangers transform. Like their kind of mega abilities feel more like massive.
Yeah, and it says more about the player abilities. That brings them down as well.
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
You know, I always assume that if someone is using Ronin, that they're 14. They should be extended like a degree of understanding.
It's like, that's the one with the sword.
Yeah, right? I wanted to be a big robot with a sword. And like, yeah, I know you did. Like,
yeah, and I part of me did as well, but I was like, no, this is not very good.
I'm a 30-year-old man.
The 30-year-old man actually fires a giant laser out of his chest. I've discovered in
the game. That's my personal. That's Ian, isn't it?
Ian.
But Ian.
I'm 31-year-old Ian.
Yeah, because it's Ian,
laser guy.
Ian Ronan.
Yeah.
Scott.
Who's the heavy one? Who's
Legion. The... Legion. Legion is the gentleman's okay. Titan.
Yeah. It's the chest of the
Someone's the chain gun.
Yeah.
I exclusively use Legion because like I like the, you know, the daft huge Titans, and he's the one that does the haka pose when he lands.
Right.
Which is fucking amazing. And now I have a great big, because I've got the first prestige level with that Titan, because I exclusively use it. And now he is canary yellow and drops out of space holding a giant orange chain gun.
Fantastic.
And it's such a good moment. And with a huge koi carp painted on the hull. What a great game. It creates, I mean, but seriously, like, it creates these, like, I tell you what, if more of my friends were into it, it would happily and fully replace Overwatch. And the reason for that is because it does continue to surprise me with stuff that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
Like, when you get the upgrade that allows you to hover changes entirely how that game is, what that game is, because suddenly you gain the ability that when you're in the air, which you spend a lot of time in the air in Titanfall,
rather than on foot or as a Titan?
On foot. You gain the ability to, I think, to crouch in midair, or is it? No, so you go iron sights in midair.
If you go both those things are fine.
Yeah. If you go to iron sights.
Crouch and go iron sights.
And this actually is visually represented in a character. If you go to iron sights in the air, these like stabilizer jets fire at your character, and then you just become this hovering gun platform and you can do it as a sniper, for example.
Oh, which, yeah.
Like, is a sudden like lateral expansion in the complexity of that game as a competitive shooter. This is all multiplayer exclusive stuff, but it makes you super vulnerable, and suddenly you've got to, you look at all those loadouts and all the stuff you've unlocked and all those, you know, all the stuff it's showered you with, and you have to like piece your own new build together to figure out how you can make best use of this particular ability, and sometimes it's rubbish and sometimes it isn't, and I don't know, I love that about it. And the my favourite thing about any multiplayer game is where you can be having different members of your team, hopefully speaking on voice chat, can be having different battles that interact with each other but sort of feel like they're taking place on different planes. So like, you know, a Titan fight between two players is interacted with by the pilots that are ripping batteries out of the Titans and plugging them into their allies.
Yeah.
But that also is shaped by the objective and whatever you're fighting over overall. And if that's a flag, then that creates all this sort of drama about the chase and everything else.
Yeah, the interaction between mechs and pilots in that game is amazing to me. Like, it was good in the first game, but the addition of the ability to pull out power cores, and then if you pulled out a power core, you can go back and throw a grenade into that slot. But also just give that power core to someone else.
Or be shot and killed yourself.
Yeah, and I mean, I enjoy playing as the character that can cloak, because that makes you completely invisible to Titan's vision, unless you double jump, in which case the flare of your jetpacks will alert them to where you are. But what I didn't realise for too long is that if you steal a power core, you hook it onto your belt and it glows bright green irrespective of whether you're cloaked or not. So it paints a massive target on your back. So I was like, I'm visible, it's fine. And then realised after like several matches that people were shooting in the air, because I was just a giant, you know, shoot me token just gliding around. But it's amazing to me that those systems just work without any kind of shonkiness. And how kind of, how well kind of programmed it is in terms of the melee kind of kill animations. If you go to a character and kill them from behind, it's kind of a neck snapping animation. But there's a video on a YouTuber GIF of someone just kind of facing into a fight, and then suddenly that animation starts, but he's already called on his Titan, and just before the guy snaps his neck, the Titan lands on his enemy and kills him. And in a lesser game, the start of that animation would have guaranteed that he was dead already. Right, it would have been like the activation of the animation kills him.
Mm.
But the animation doesn't kill him until the actual next snap, allowing someone else to shoot him off or for his titan to take him down. And it's that kind of very, very, that massive attention to detail and the way that these systems are interacting that you just don't see in a typical shooter.
And often you don't notice it then when you're in the flow of playing. That's ultimately, again, to loop back to where we started, that is the key to why that movement system is so good.
Mm.
Because it is making the correct assumption about what you're hoping happens so much of the time, what feels right, that it very rarely confronts you with, you know, actually, technically, you did this, so we're going to do that. So, like, one example is if you grapple onto a titan, it will always put you towards that titan as that titan moves. So that will always, on an enemy titan, that will always, almost always ultimately pull you into the mounting that titan position unless you disconnect the line.
Mm.
But you can, you know, like, do stuff, like, if you are about to fly over your own titan and you want to get into it, you can, like, throw the line down behind you, but it'll whip you over it in, like, a huge arc, and sometimes bring it, like, background underneath it, and you'll end up doing, like, the slide between the legs, which feels like, you know, it'd be so, not easy, but it would be so easy to sort of almost skip to the end of those interactions and just have you, like, zip in when you've used the grapple hook on your titan, but everything feels like this great kind of precarious, like, you know, you know, very physical adventure all the time, but
And the idea that at any point in all that animation, it's like you could be shot out of it.
Yeah,
is that everything is always interacting with everything all the time. Everything's alive in the game world, and that's key to a game that relies on so many just fast interactions between these enormously different power sets between titans and individual runners. I think it's just an incredible piece of work. I think it's a real kind of landmark for movement design in first person games. People should play it.
I said this in my review, but it's heartbreaking that the first game failed to find an audience despite brilliant ideas because of bad business decisions that were made probably above the level of designers who made those brilliant decisions, right? Like season passes and all that. This game seems to struggle to find an audience because it was released directly between Battlefield and Call of Duty, which was crazy.
Yeah.
And hopefully, the fact that they're doing the right stuff with the business model this year will mean that it survives.
Hmm.
Because by all accounts, like Rainbow Six Siege is now thriving, which is an equally complicated game. Like, I don't think the argument that complicated shooters can't sell flies at all. Right. Floats, flies, anything, either of those.
In Titanfall, anything can happen.
Yeah. Grapples.
Rainbow Six Siege has been a slow burn, but you know, several of our friends have been sort of so enthusiastic about and their enthusiasm has lasted, whereas like with Overwatch it flared and then died.
Yeah.
And so maybe Titanfall will have that like long tail success.
I really hope so. Because they have all the hooks in there to charge people more money for it. So there's loads and loads of cosmetic stuff, which is just perfect for that game because you want to make your Titan look cool. All the pilots look really different and interesting. You can kind of adapt that stuff.
Mm.
But they, as far as I'm aware, they're not charging for any sort of cosmetic stuff yet.
Not yet. I believe that's going to be in the first DLC.
Which is, you know, that's the kind of stuff I'm offering. Fine. Like, that's the way you make money out of me in this game. They've introduced Angel City, which is the best map from the first game. And that's now just in regular rotation. And that was free. So just go and enjoy that map for free. And if that's the way they're going to do things, then what the fuck else can a studio do to make an amazing shooter and get an audience? So hopefully. I hope it does very, very well.
We should say what our games of the year are.
Our
personal picks.
You're right.
Oh yeah,
for number one.
Ooh, Tom, you should start.
Mine is Dishonored 2.
I'm going to pick XCOM 2.
Subnautica.
Dishonored 2.
Shall we find out what some of our readers said?
Rather than do questions this week, we asked you, not you specifically, person listening to this who's now
maybe
worried that
that person is Mike Begg, we did.
Yeah. but some of you to tell us on Twitter and email what your choices were.
They should be pretty quick because they're not questions.
Exactly.
We have to answer them.
So we're not going to answer these, but we're going to read out some of your selections because they seem like a good idea.
Mike Begg writes, "Hello folks. My game of the year probably has to be XCOM 2. Took everything that the first game did and refined it, plus added a bunch of funky extra stuff and the excitement of the underdog situation. Sunk many hours into it and would happily do so again. Honourable mention to Titanfall 2 and its fantastic campaign, and just general inclusion of giant robots, but haven't had much fun with the multiplayer. Also, Deus Ex Mankind Divided for its fun and satisfying mechanics and wonderful world to explore, but lackluster story. I have a terrible memory, so it's possible I may have forgotten about much better games. Keep on potting, Mike.
No, bang on, XCOM 2.
Yeah, they are, yeah, that's 1 point in the Tom Senior category.
Yes!
J. Richard Eddy writes, I wish I had something edgier or more indie to nominate, but it has to be XCOM 2.
Yes!
Turn-based tactics are my favourite games to begin with, and XCOM 2 reaches a level of elegance and cohesion that's rare to see in any genre. Honourable mention to Persona 5, which is not a PC game, and also not a game of this year unless you know Japanese. Good pick.
Tom Senior's killing it so far.
Someone says heat signature, but I can't read that one.
It's too late.
It's not out. Andy writes, The Witcher 3, Blood and Wine, a storytelling tour de force.
Another Tom Senior one.
It's great.
Monkey Hammer says, Hitman TM. It managed to innovate and improve as the episodes were released. A beautifully systematic clockwork puzzle. And Terence Bad says, The Witness, because of a few truly jaw-dropping moments, realising that what the puzzles were doing or how to solve them. Varanas says, Steven Sausage Roll. Simple and intuitive rules, yet so many of the puzzles seem impossible until you solve them. Steven Rancourt says, The Witness. First game I ever tried to get all the achievements for because I love the progression of learning on each laser. Zed Fang, Warhammer Total War, feels like Creative Assembly's formula finally clicked. Glorious spectacle and diverse gameplay. Good King Kenslaslas. I don't know what this person's normal Twitter name is, but I think that's a Christmas Twitter name. I'm undecided, it's so tough. Hitman, Dark Souls 3, Pokemon Sun and Moon, Titanfall 2, Tokyo Mirage Sessions, Doom, The Witness, Civ 6, this goes on, and I haven't played Dishonored 2 or Final Fantasy 15 yet either.
Man Between Worlds.
Barry Hon says, Firewatch. I was pleasantly surprised at the Far Cry 2 style map, and then I remembered it was by the Idle Thumbs crew. Keys McQueen says, Doom, because like Wolfenstein The New Order, it put a modern twist on a classic shooter formula and was a great success. And that's it.
No votes for Dishonored 2.
Nope.
Wow. Are you fucking kidding?
Maybe they just figured you guys would have it covered. I mean, that like bonus pod was like, what, 5 hours long? 7? 12? 43?
Amazingly, we still can't stop talking about it.
Yep.
We took a break during recording last week's pod just to talk about Dishonored more.
And we still also talked about it on the pod a bit.
Boy, well, that's all of the 2016
all the year.
We have time for.
It's all the year we have the year for.
So we... I saw the excellent bourbon we have in the bottle almost. That's gone.
Yep,
real quick. Well,
that's a lot of 50% on that, which was just
I'm sure it doesn't show, guys. I'm sure it's fine.
The dash of water is really the way to drink this.
Yes,
I think
a lot of the flavour.
I think he actually suggested that, and he's right.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion, and a great bottle of whiskey. And I've forgotten where I was going with this. It was ending the podcast. Yes, that's what we were doing. We were signing off. We will be back in early January. We don't know exactly when yet because we've got to negotiate some travel-y things that people are doing work trips and so on. Like, I know.
Birthdays. But I thought that was really subtle.
I think it might have been on the audio version of this podcast.
Oh, yeah. No, I did the look.
Yeah. So we will be back a few weeks from now. We're going to take our Christmas break, and that's that, really. If you'd like to send us a question for the new year, you can do so by emailing... oh my God, that's a really good button. You can email us at questions@creightoncrowbar.com. You can tweet us at creightoncrowbar. You can also discuss this episode and just hang out with the community over the break, which I know I will, because... rad group of people who send us booze. On our Discord channel, the link for which is in the show notes. You can also follow us as individuals. I'm at C Thurston, that's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N. Pip is...
I'm at Philippa Waugh, which is at P-H-I-L-I-P-P-A-W-A-R-R.
I'm so glad we finally captured what that looks like.
I had to free my hands.
Tom Senior is
At PCG Ludo, and Ludo is L-U-D-O.
And I, Tom Francis, am Pentadact at P-E-N-T-A-D-A-C-T.
That's the way you self-announce, that's good. It's been a good year for games, hasn't it?
This list made me realise that it has been a really good year for games.
We've got four immersive sims, and that's all I
Never have I felt more strongly about qualifying four games at the end of that a sentence that begins that way. But nonetheless, look at this. Look at this massive list of things. Like, when I recorded the PC Gamer Game of the Year thing podcast, I couldn't remember what kind of game year it had been. And then I realised that that's my fault.
A good one is what it's been. And there's some sales and things on, so hopefully people can pick things up and catch up over Christmas and stuff.
Like stuff like Inside and, you know, if you like Abzu and that sort of stuff. That's still,
if you're into that kind of
Vibe, then
other Undersea options are available.
But no, wonderful year for games.
All links to all of the games we've discussed on this podcast will be in the show notes if you want to check out anything, and I'll include Graham and Marsh's picks in that as well. So, yeah. Merry Christmas, everybody!
Perfect.